Tonight we have the distinct pleasure and honor of welcoming Kojin Bohanic back for part two of the Mahabharata. It was awesome, an awesome journey last week. I was delighted with what we and I got to learn last week. And let's jump right in and continue with this incredible epic. Welcome, Kojin.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you all for coming. I'd like to again thanks Rob and Jim for having me here. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm glad that you all made it. So we have an ambitious event tonight. The first half is not so hard because I just talk into the point where we ran out of time. The second half is a little bit harder because I have to actually finish the story. So I'll try not to confuse anybody too much. And then once again, you know, I understand that the lineage and the names are very, very confusing and very, very hard to follow. So if anybody here has any questions about, you know, who's that guy again, who's that person again, please feel free to raise your hand. I'm going to start with a very brief review going over the lineage that we went over last week, and then I believe I'm going to just jump right into the story here. Just out of curiosity, a show of hands, is there anybody here who was not here last week? Okay, not bad. Okay, good. Just wondering because I want to know how much I should go over stuff. Okay, so the Mahabharata, yeah, ancient Indian epic poetry, it's post-Vedic material. I think it's after the Vedic era, around 500 before the Common Era is when it's written. There's a lot of distinct features to this. It's one of the major epic poetry, the other one being Ramayana. So you can think of Mahabharata as the story of Krishna, and Ramayana being the story of Rama. Okay. Last week we went over some of the outer framing of the story. That is to say, the story has multiple layers of framing. You have one layer, and then two characters will tell another story, and then another character will tell another story, and another character will tell another story to the point where you can't really remember what the outer layer of the story is. So that's one of the confusing features about the Mahabharata. The outermost layer of the story is that the Earth Mother Prithvi is being, or Bhumi, she's being oppressed by the rebirth of the Asuras on the planet. They're being born as Kshatriyas, as people of the warrior caste. And they're destroying the Earth, and they're messing it up. And so she goes to the gods, and she says, you know, help me. And they all shrug their shoulders. We don't know what to do. Let's go talk to Vishnu. So Vishnu says, okay, I will be reborn, and we'll take care of the problem. So the outermost frame, and keep this in mind, because tonight we're going to get really, really violent, and there's some pretty terrible things that happen. And this is kind of I suppose you could look at it as the way that the tradition justifies this violence, or maybe in some sense why the violence is, I guess you could say, justified, is because the outermost framing is that there's just simply this overpopulation, if you will, of power-hungry people who are fighting for power and hurting the earth, and Krishna has come down here with the explicit purpose to exterminate them, right? So it's a very, very tough subject, particularly when we're in an era of ongoing conflict and wars and possible impending wars. So it's very chilling to be reading this stuff and talking about this stuff in current political situations. So anyway, that's the outermost framing of the story. As you get farther in, you have the story of Vyasa telling the story to Ganesha, as Ganesha's transcribing it. You have the sage Vaishampayana, who's a student of Vyasa, listening to the transcription of the story. And then we have King Janamejaya, who's performing the Sartha Medha, the extermination for all the Nagas, the race of I guess you can think of it as a genocide or a holocaust against the Nagas, which are a serpent sort of quasi-divine sort of snake being, because he's doing that as revenge for killing his father, Parikshit. And if you remember, it was Parikshit's karma because he threw the snake on the dead, on the meditating sage, and the son of that sage cursed him to die of a snake bite. He died of a snake bite, and now his son Janamejaya is mad and wants revenge. So Janamejaya is having this giant yajna, this giant sacrifice that will bring up all the power, and it creates this kind of an urge where all the Nagas are impelled to just throw their bodies into the fire. And it's a very harrowing scene. And so in the midst of this, in order to complete the ritual, Janamejaya needs to know the story of his family lineage. So he goes to Vaishampayana. He says, Vaishampayana, what is the story of my family? And Vaishampayana Ubacha, he says, all of this, everything that we're doing, right? So on the one level, Vyasa is transcribing it to Ganesha. On the other hand, what happened is Janamejaya is being told by Vaishampayana this story. Right? So this is the bottom part of the lineage. Right? Parikshit, is the son of Abhimanyu, who we're going to hear about his story and his death today. And his father, his I guess Parikshit's grandfather would be Arjuna, and Janamejaya's great-grandfather would be Arjuna, okay? So here on this chart, we have the Kauravas and the Pandavas. I like to refer them as heroes and anti-heroes. I don't really like to call the Kauravas villains, because I don't really believe that this story has that sort of a Manichaean sort of element to it, like good versus evil. I mean, there's some of that sort of language, but really what you find is that the Pandavas, the heroes, do bad things, and the villains do good things, and vice versa. So it's not quite as black and white as perhaps we might be more comfortable if it was more like that. You know, Ramayana, on the other hand, is very black and white. It's very easy. You know, Rama's killing the bad, evil sorcerer who kidnapped his wife. Basic. Mahabharata, we don't get such clarity. Things are a lot more confused. Okay, so these are our two main sets of characters, the Pandavas and the Kauravas, and everything is centering around this crisis in succession. Who's going to inherit the throne? Okay, so up at the top half, we have Yayati and the lineage from which Krishna comes from. Out of that is produced Shantanu. Shantanu has first wife with Ganga, who he has seven kids, of which she kills, or eight kids, of which she kills seven, as a promise to the Vasus, who were reborn because of their curse with stealing the cow from the sage. So she promised to have them be spared the indignity of being born from a mortal womb, and the promises to commit infanticide as soon as they're born so they don't have to be living as a human being, which is a very terrible thing considered to be a human in this realm. So of those, the eighth one she does not want to kill, Bhishma, but also Shantanu stops her. So there's multiple things going on here. And also Bhishma is cursed because he was the ringleader of these Vasus, that he has to actually live out the whole life. Okay, so later on, once Shantanu stops Bhishma, or stops Ganga from killing Bhishma, she now takes him up to heaven, goes up to heaven, and leaves. And Shantanu is now meeting Satyavati, right? Satyavati is, if you recall, she was the one who was born inside the fish. And Satyavati, when she was a young lady, she was doing the ferry duty for her father, the fisherman. And part of the Sharda, the Rishi, the sage, propositions her, and she says, no, no. And he persists, and she says, okay, restore my virginity, get rid of my smell, and fog, thank you, so that nobody can see. So, and then basically from that, we have our Vedic Vyasa, right? So he's a very, very major player in all of this. And again, back to our frame, and Vyasa is the one who's narrating this all to Ganesha. I know this is very confusing, especially if you weren't here last week, so forgive me. We will get to some stuff that's going to go a little bit slower. I'm mostly just saying this to jog people's memories, okay? So now Satyavati meets up with Shantanu. Shantanu goes to Satyavati's father. Will you give me your daughter? He says, only if you make him their son that they have together the heir to the throne. Shantanu is distraught because he already has Bhishma, and primogeniture dictates that he gets everything. So Bhishma finds out, goes to the father, the fisherman father, and says, I vow to be celibate and to honor whoever is sitting in the throne. And because of that, all the gods come down and chant, Bhishma, Bhishma, awesome, awesome. And so he gets named Bhishma because he's so awesome. All right. Shantanu and Satyavati have two sons. Again, I can never say this guy's name because you only see his name a couple times. Chitrarangada, okay? Gosh, dead, okay? Then Vichitravirya lives a little bit longer, but not much longer. Bhishma, this story will become very, very important this evening. Bhishma goes to get his brother Vichitravirya some wives, so he kidnaps Amba, Ambalika, and Ambika, right? Amba is already engaged with another man. She gets dropped off the chariot, goes back to the man. Man says, nope, you were already with Bhishma. She goes to Vichitravirya. Vichitravirya rejects her, says, nope, you already love another man. Then she goes to Bhishma and says, you have to marry me. And Bhishma says, no, I'm celibate because of my promise to the fisherman father. Okay, so Amba basically gets put in a bad situation, and she turns into a very, very key figure that we will see tonight. So, and also some very interesting gender things that happen in this story based on that. Okay, so Vichitravirya dies tuberculosis before he is able to produce an heir. And so there's a crisis in lineage because there's no children. The lineage has now stopped. Who's going to take the throne? And in this type of monarch, succession, power vacuum is a very dangerous thing. If you don't have a clear succession, then you will have people fighting for power, and that, you know, is really bad. So what happens is Satyavati says, oh, by the way, Shantanu, before we were together, back when I was young, I did have another kid named Vyasa. And, you know, according to the law, he can come in and he can impregnate the wives. This is the idea of a woman is a kshetra, is a, like a field, right? So in this sort of world, where this world view and that of like the Manava Shastra, Dharma Shastra sort of material, the women don't actually contribute anything to the production of a son, as you recall from Drona being born in a pot. The women are just kind of like the field in which the seed is planted, is the thought, right? So based on that, whoever owns the field, so to speak, again, I know that there's some kind of gender stuff here that's not really too cool, but whoever owns the field, so to speak, gets to keep the crop. It doesn't matter who planted the seed, right? So in this sort of sense, it's legal for Vyasa to come in and plant the seed in Vichitravirya's field, so to speak, and produce a harvest, children, that will still be considered Vichitravirya's kids. Okay, just to kind of explain some of the complexities of the dharmic sort of things behind this. So he does. First one closes her eyes. He gets angry because, remember, he's a really dirty sage, you know, that does asceticism, matted hair, and, you know, they're wearing rags. First one closes her eyes because she doesn't want to do it. And he curses her. He becomes angry. Has Dhritarashtra from that one, the blind king. The second one turns white, and he curses her. Her son will be Pandu, means like the pale dude, you know. So he's this kind of like pale, sickly-looking guy, right? And now the problem here is the first son is blind, and first son, blind son cannot rule the kingdom. Okay, again, a little prejudice against handicap, I suppose, or differently abled. So Dhritarashtra cannot rule. Pandu goes to rule in his place, but then Pandu has a mishap in which he's hunting, shoots two deer, what he thinks are two deer mating. Remember, it's a sage who is doing this for some reason. I kind of want to say fetishy, but okay, whatever. So I'm not judging the sage. That's what he likes to do. So Pandu Pandu shoots the dying deer, turns into sage, and says, that's unsportsman. You don't shoot two animals while they're mating. And because of that, I'm going to curse you. If you ever have sex again, you're dead. Okay? So now Pandu has got this wife, Kunti and Madri, and of which the younger one is irresistible to him, much like Kekeyi in the Ramayana. Okay? So Pandu doesn't have any heir at this point. Dhritarashtra, on the other hand, well, we'll get to that in a second. So Pandu doesn't have any heir. So they move to the forest and they practice asceticism. He basically abdicates the kingdom to his brother, goes off into the kingdom, to the forest to form asceticism, and then basically loses control over himself and conjugal rape-ish with Madri, okay? And then Pandu dies right on the spot because he broke the curse. Okay, so now it turns out that Kunti, before she was with Pandu, she had a pre-experience where she got a mantra from a sage for, you know, pleasing him, and the mantra was that she could have a child with whatever god she wants. She first tried it out when she was young and had Karna with the sun god. Okay. Years later, she meets and marries Pandu. Pandu dies. They don't have kids. They don't have a lineage. Crisis. What happens? Who becomes king? She says, oh, by the way, I have this mantra. We can use the mantra. She uses it three times. She gives it to Madri to use twice. From the first, we have Yudhisthira, who's the incarnation or the son of Dharma. We have Bhima, who is the son of Vayu, the wind. And we have Arjuna, who is the son of Indra, the god of storm. And then she lets Madri use it so that she can have some kids too, and she invokes the Ashvins, which are Vedic twins, twin deities. And from that comes Nakula and Sahadeva. Okay, so now they have heir together, right? And then just to continue the lineage, this is part of the story we'll tell today. At a certain point, Arjuna marries Subhadra, who is Krishna's sister. They together have Abhimanyu. Abhimanyu gets together with Uttara. They have Parikshit, and then Parikshit, his son is Janamejaya, and that completes our lineage. So, and then again, the story starting with.
And that's the whole story. Right. So I'll go home. There's a war in the middle of that, and whatever. So this is the framing of the story, is the Jana Magi Obacha, or Vaishampayana Obacha to Jana Magi. Okay. Now everybody's clear on that. Where we left off last week, I believe, if my memory is serving me, we have these sets of cousins, the Pandavas and the Kauravas, who are now coming of age, and they're training with Sensei Drona. Right? They finished their training with Sensei Drona. As you recall, you know, maybe some of the highlights of that was the Ekalavya instance where he orders Ekalavya to cut off his thumb. The other part is how Drona got the job, his background with Drupada. I remember they were poor as kid, or he was poor and went to his friend Drupada to help him who'd become a king, and Drupada says, "You're not my equal, don't talk to me." So he gets upset and vows revenge. He gets work in Hastinapura as the guru, the teacher, the martial arts teacher, the sensei, to the Pandavas and the Kauravas. And now it's time for Dakshina, Guru Dakshina. Time for the gift. So it's customary that you give a gift to your guru when you're finished training with them. And what does he want? He wants revenge on his childhood friend Drupada, who refused him. So he sends the Pandavas out, or first he sends the Kauravas. Kauravas don't do the job. Then he sends the Pandavas back to get Drupada, brings him the chains. This is all still review. Brings him back in chains and then takes half his kingdom and says, "See, now I'm half your equal." Okay. So that's how that happens. So now you have this situation where the crisis has kind of been put off. There was always the question, well, who's going to get the kingdom? Is it going to be Duryodhana or is it going to be Yudhishthira? And nobody, you know, everybody's kind of not really too clear on this. And my feelings is a lot of the elders were kind of sitting back and just checking out the qualities of these guys. You know, what were they like? You know? And so now we have a crisis situation. They've come to age, their training's finished, they're graduated college. You know, it's time for them to be employed. Okay, who gets what job? You know, so the crisis is now who's the heir, right? And now one of the things that I like to point out is that Duryodhana makes a pretty good case for it, you know. He argues that Pandu is technically not the father, even though according to like the Manava Dharma Shastra, which is kind of an old legal book you can think of, technically that was all legal, that arrangement, you know, where they were born. Because again, Kunti is the field, right? So technically that was a legal arrangement because Kunti is the field property of her husband, right? So it was a legal arrangement. But that's one of the points that Duryodhana brings out, is that these guys, you know, Pandu's not even their father, right? And then also that he gave up the throne, you know, when he went to practice asceticism, you know, when he got that curse. So that made Dhritarashtra the king, and that also makes Duryodhana then his heir. So his thinking is that, you know, and then also, you know, Dhritarashtra is the king, but also, you know, he wasn't the king just because he was blind, and I guess you can make a case for, like, well, he's still the king, too. So Duryodhana kind of makes a pretty strong case for the kingdom, right? And then the Pandavas, basically, I think on this side of it, I think you can really see that Duryodhana's character is coming out a lot. Particularly in this training, he's under the influence of his uncle, his maternal uncle, who's going to be very, very important here in a minute. And his maternal uncle is basically got a vendetta against the whole family, right? And so he's kind of like turning Duryodhana against Yudhishthira, actually Yudhishthira and largely Bhima too, and he's trying to create this fight. So what's happening is Duryodhana does all these kind of corrupt things, like he tries to poison Bhima, and he does all this. So is there in college, you know, in the guru school, in the gurukula with Drona, the, you know, you're starting to see that you know, Duryodhana is not really a nice guy. You know, he's doing some really, he's power hungry, you know, he's kind of angry, he's jealous, you know, he's got all these kind of qualities. Whereas Yudhishthira, being the son of Dharma, is righteous, you know, he's often later referred to as Dharma Raja, right, the Dharma King. So you really see the Duryodhana's character coming out. But at the same time, I really don't think that, I mean, there certainly are places in the Mahabharata where they're very clear that, you know, the Pandavas, that Yudhishthira is the rightful heir. But I also think that they leave enough doubt in it to make the text a little more sophisticated, you know, so that it's a little bit more complex, and there's a certain amount of moral ambiguity in this question, but there's more ambiguity in as we see in the strategies and what people are doing in the warfare, etc., later. So there's a certain moral ambiguity built into this. So at one point, Duryodhana now goes to Dhritarashtra, his father, and this is considered Dhritarashtra's major fault, and this is what he ends up lamenting at the end of the war, is that he's easily manipulated by his son. He loves his son so much that he's very easily manipulated by him. So Duryodhana goes to his father, Dhritarashtra, and says, you know, these guys are going to cause us problems. Basically, the people at the court, they are not really sure which one of us should be the king, you know, me or Yudhishthira. Why don't we get rid of them for a little while? Send them away to a festival. Have them leave town. And when they're gone, then we can kind of turn the people on our side. Yeah.
You didn't actually talk about the return of Karna.
Yeah, well, that was part of what happened in the previous lecture.
No, but you didn't get to that.
Yeah, I didn't mention it this time.
Okay.
Well, he came during the tournament, and I didn't talk about that last time. Didn't I talk
no.
about the tournament?
You
really?
Didn't talk about
that should have been back then.
Yeah,
that's a very important point. Wow. Okay, if I skipped the tournament, that's not good. So at the end of the guru training with Drona, there's basically a tournament to show off all the skills, right? And Karna shows up and he wants to compete. First of all, way back when, Karna approached Drona and said, "Hey, will you train me?" And Drona says, "No, you're of a low caste." And now again, Karna shows up and wants to compete in the tournament, you know? And what happens is they go, "Oh, no, you're a Sutta. You're a low caste. You're this chariot caste." And he gets rejected, right? This is actually a really important point. I'm glad that you reminded me if I didn't mention it already. Because what happens with Karna then is he basically is not discriminated against, but Duryodhana sees an opportunity. And he says, "You know what? I'm going to make him a kshatriya because I'm going to award him some land." So he gives him his land grant and basically says, "Now he's a king. Okay, now he can compete." But then, you know, the elders kind of go, "No, this isn't really legal." And again, Karna gets discriminated against. So this becomes this thing where Karna's an interesting character, but now he becomes a lifelong, devoted, loyal friend to Yudhishthira. Right? Or Duryodhana, excuse me. So he becomes a life... Oh, no, my... He becomes a lifelong devoted friend to Duryodhana at the expense of everything else, and he his loyalty to Duryodhana on one hand is admirable, but on the other hand there's a sort of moral lesson with Karna about what happens if you kind of place your values in the wrong spot, so to speak. So that forms an alliance. So thank you for reminding me with that. So that's that. So anyway, back to Duryodhana convinces his dad to send the Pandavas away, right? Now, he doesn't tell his father this, but he actually plots to have them killed. So they build a house of lock. Lock, I guess, is like this kind of gum residue, right? And they fill this whole house with all of this flammable stuff, right? And the plan is, we're going to have this big party, everybody's going to go to sleep, we're going to light the fire, and Pandavas and their mother, even Kunti, is with them, will all be killed, right? And then we'll be done with the problem. Now, Dhritarashtra doesn't know that that's the plan, but that's what Duryodhana's plan is. He's also under some influences as well, too. So they send him away, but it turns out that the Pandavas find out about the plan. And again, we have a case of discrimination against the Nishada. So what they do is they find a family of a Nishada lady with 5 sons, right? They invite them over to the party, right? And then they have like this tunnel, you know, I guess they sneak out, and then they light it on fire, and poof, you know. They fake their own death, basically, by killing the Nishadas, right? And it's a really tragic scene, especially since there's not really a sort of moral judgment against this. You know, you would think that this would be like a terrible thing. It's just not even really, it's kind of assumed that there's kind of expendable people, you know. Then the Ekalavya, where the cutting of the thumb, he's a Nishada as well, too, remember. It gets justified, like, Duryodhana had a foresight that he was part of a tribe that would be a threat to Hastinapura, and he saw that in the future there would be a war, and he decided to stop that right now by having him cut off his thumb. That kind of gets justified a little bit more. But these Nishadas get burned, and there's not really much said about that. So then the Pandavas basically realize that, you know, this is what we're dealing with. We need some time to figure things out. So instead of just cruising on back to Hastinapura, they decide to adopt disguise as Brahmins or as ascetics, and they go wandering, right? So incognito, right? So while everybody thinks that they're dead. Hey, Tom. Tom, can you sit in that chair over there? And then can you be my little light? It's almost a copy can. Okay, so this is like the first exile of the Pandavas. In a sense, this kind of foreshadows their later exile from the kingdom. But this is the first one, right? And many different things happen in this particular episode, right? And I'm not going to really point out all of those things, but there's a couple little points here that I would like to make. One is the episode with Hidimba, which actually I really like this story a lot, and Ghatotkacha, right? So at a certain point, they're in the forest, they're wandering, and they're all sleeping, and this is this Rakshasa named Hidimba, that's a short A, not the long A that we have there, Hidimba, smells them, and he says, oh, you know, because these guys eat blood, right? They eat flesh, and he's like, oh, and so he sends his sister, he says, go get those guys, we're going to kill them and eat them, right? Hidimba goes, and just as she's about to pounce on them, she checks out Bhima, and she's like, that is a big hunk of man there. And and he is. I mean, he's this giant guy. Actually, when they were running from the burning house of Lak, he literally picks up all the Pandavas and Kunti, throws them all on his shoulders, and he's just running. You know, it's just like this weird scene where he's carrying his whole family running. So yeah, he is a big hunk of man there. So Hidimba likes him, and she's like, I'm into this, right? So she kind of, you know, propositions him. And he's kind of going for it. But the brother, her brother, the Rakshasa, this Rakshasi, this demoness, her brother is like, you know, gets upset and comes to kill. And actually, Hidimba, the sister, protects Bhima from her brother. So at this point, she's like, she loves Bhima so much that she decides to go with this. And one of the things that I wrote there is this is a very stark contrast to, there's a lot of contrast you can make with Mahabharata and the Ramayana. And this is a stark contrast to the way Sharpanika is treated by Rama and Lakshmana. We have a similar situation where Rakshasi, demoness, propositions Rama and Lakshmana. But in this situation, she's rejected and actually mutilated. Her nose is cut off and her ears are cut off. It's kind of a punishment for her sexual out-of-controlness, which is highly threatening. This situation is actually pretty much the opposite, where Bhima and Ghatotkacha, actually, Bhima and Hidimba have a very, very erotic episode. I mean, it talks about how they, you know, make love for like months on the mountains. I mean, it's just really kind of passionate affair that happens. And out of that is produced Ghatotkacha, which is will now be the son of Bhima in this Rakshasi, right? This ogress, or this, you know, I don't know what you want to call it in English, but Rakshasi. Alright, so this is one of the things that happens. Ghatotkacha is going to play a fairly important role in our war later, because he takes care of a weapon that could have otherwise been used on Arjuna. So in a sense, he indirectly saves Arjuna's life. Then the other thing is they hear about Draupadi's Swayamvara. Okay, so if you recall back to Sensei Drona, when he was a kid, he grew up with his buddy Drupada. His Drupada goes on to become a king. He goes on to become poor, goes to his buddy Drupada, help me out. He says, how dare you talk to me as equals? You're not my equal. Get out of my face. Drona vows revenge on his friend Drupada. And then for the Guru Dakshina, when his students, the Kauravas and the Pandavas, have now come of age, he says, go get me Drupada, right? So Drupada is now humiliated from Drona, because, you know, it keeps going back and forth, right, the cycle of violence here. And what he does is he has a yajna to have a son. He wants to have a son specifically that will kill Drona, right? So out of this fire is produced two. Drishtadyumna and his sister Draupadi, right? So his sister Draupadi is now coming of age, and she is she's having Swayamvara. Swayamvara is like a self-choice. You guys remember the story of Robin Hood, right? Isn't that? There's a Swayamvara there, like Maid Marian. And Robin Hood, Maid Marian is having a contest for her hand, I suppose, and all the guys coming to compete. You know, Robin Hood disguises himself, and she knows it's him or whatever. There's a Swayamvara. This is an old Indo-European kind of motif of how women, it's like they, I mean, they, what it literally means is women choosing their husband, you know, and they have a big thing, and they check out all the guys, and they go, I like that one, you know. I mean, I suppose that's part of what happens, but, you know, a lot of it is really, she may not have much of a choice at all, but the idea behind it is that she at least does. So Draupadi now, daughter of Drupada is going to have Swayamvara to pick a husband. And the Pandavas hear about this, right? And they decide to go compete in Swayamvara, right? And again, this is very similar to the episode in Ramayana where Rama breaks Shiva's bow and wins Sita's hand, right? So here, likewise, Arjuna just goes and basically kicks butt at this thing, right? Now, Karna also is there, but again, Karna gets discriminated against because of his caste. His supposed caste. Remember, that's not really his caste. It's his supposed caste, because he's actually the king, because he's the oldest out of all of these guys. And at a certain point, Krishna even points that out to him. It's like, Krishna, he's like, Karna, dude, you can stop this whole war right now. Just go to Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira is a righteous guy, and say, hey, man, I'm your older brother. It's my kingdom. And I say, we don't fight. Right? And you know how Karna responds. Karna says, no way am I turning my back on Duryodhana. After every one of these people has discriminated against me over and over and over again, and the one guy who helped me out, I'm not turning my back on him. You know, screw them. You know, and so the war happens. But anyway, here's another example. Karna gets refused because of his caste. This is a very sympathetic attitude towards Karna in the literature, and even in the later literature and culture, and a lot of people are named after Karna. Even though technically he fought with what you may call the villains, even though he technically fought on the wrong side, he's not going to die, is he? Oh, I'll be so sad at this moment. In the middle of my lecture. Maybe I'm too trigger happy with it. I should preserve it. This is so fun. So Karna gets refused again, okay? And then at this point, Arjuna wins the Swayamvara. You know, he's set up to meet, to marry Draupadi. And this is actually where Krishna Balarama enter the story, okay? The Lord Krishna, okay? The one who is the incarnated Vishnu who's come to exterminate the asuras who are oppressing the Mother Earth. This is our first appearance of him in Mahabharata. He comes in with his brother Balarama, and basically they congratulate Arjuna. They say, hey, good job, nice work. And they kind of become friends, okay? And this friendship develops a little bit later here. The Pandavas are now revealed, because, you know, who else can shoot like that? These guys are not Brahmins, you know? And so they become revealed. So they know, because of the Swayamvara, that the Pandavas are in fact alive. And back in Hastinapura, there's like, okay, the Pandavas are not dead. And now they're pissed. What are we going to do? Right? Then Kunti's word, okay? So Kunti is an amazing figure in the literature in that she's one of the only examples where a woman has multiple husbands, right?
Not Kunti.
Draupadi. Sorry, I'm a little tired, so I'm going to mix names up. So Draupadi, so Arjuna just won Draupadi's hand, right, in the Swayamvara. So, Kunti, the Pandava's mother, thinks that they've been out like collecting food or whatever, and they come back, and Draupadi's like, or Kunti, the mother, is like turned around and doesn't see what's happening. Arjuna walks in the door and says, hey mom, look what I got, you know? And she's thinking that they've been out on alms. When they're getting to collecting their alms, they just split it. And so she says, oh, just split it with your brothers like you do everything else, right? And everybody kind of goes, uh-oh, you know? Now remember, the parents' word is sacred. Right? It's the word. It's like the word of a god, you know. So you cannot make anything that your parent says untrue. So this is how Draupadi ends up with five husbands. She has to marry all of these brothers. And she doesn't get a lot of help with the housework either. She's really described in these amazing terms: the first one to rise, the last one to go to sleep, never eats. You know, just like this kind of ideal.
I'm gonna take care of
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But having five husbands is probably a lot like having 25 children, I imagine. So this is how they end up. So anyway, they're revealed. The word gets back to Hastinapura that the Pandavas are still alive. And this creates a crisis. And you know what? There's Bhishma, and there's Drona, and there's Vidurta, these guys in the court who are pretty righteous guys. And they basically say to Dhritarashtra, they say, hey man, you know, your family just tried to kill these guys. If you don't do something to make that right, there's going to be a big war and it's going to get really, really messy. You have to give them something, right? And so basically it's decided that they're going to give them some land. They're going to give them the Kandava forest, right? It's this, you know, it's not exactly fair because Hastinapura is this beautiful giant city, you know, and majestic buildings and everything else. And kind of a forest is kind of like on the backwater, right? It's not been cleared. It's like a You know, it's not good for agriculture. It's just it's an old forest, right? So it's not exactly fair. But you know, Yudhishthira is being the righteous guy that he was. He would just accept whatever to avoid the conflict, which is, you know, at a certain point he asked for just 5 villages, you know, to avoid war, you know. And, you know, Duryodhana's constant response is, I would not give them even enough land to stick a pin in, right? And so this is, you know, pointing to Duryodhana's greed, right? Because it's depicted that at any time, if Duryodhana would have just given a little to them, the whole thing could have been avoided, right? But he's greedy, he's angry, he's jealous, he's all of these things, okay? So basically that's how that happens, okay? So now let me throw another little side note in here. At this point in the story, Arjuna goes to visit his buddy Krishna that he just met at the Swayamvara, right? Krishna and Balarama. They're distant cousins because the Yayati lineage, how do I not tell this story? You remember the Yayati lineage? He gets cursed to become old before his time. And if he can trade it with one of his sons, it'll be okay. All of his sons refuse except for Puru, the youngest one. And so Puru inherits the lineage, and then therefore all these guys are Pauravas. These guys are the descendants of Puru. Well, the other son, Yadu, gets exiled and banished over to Mathura, right? And so that's the lineage from which Krishna comes. So they have a common ancestor here, Yayati. So they're kind of related.
What?
So
Kunti, they're more closely related.
Kunti is Krishna's aunt, I believe, if that works out right. But that's a whole nother confusing.
Yeah, he keeps calling Arjuna by, O son of Kunti, to remind him of his relation.
Yeah. Okay, so Subhadra. And so now at this point, Arjuna goes to visit his new buddies in Dvaraka, right? Mathura becomes under siege, they go to Dvaraka, and he marries Krishna's sister, Subhadra. And again, the reason I'm pointing this out is because Arjuna marrying Subhadra creates Abhimanyu, Parikshit, and Janamejaya. Okay, so that's where that whole lineage comes from. Okay, Vanna? All right, so the Pandavas are now the proud recipients of this crappy land. The kind of a forest, right? But it's not uninhabited, right? Who lives there? Who said that? Good. The snakes live there. The snakes are living there. Okay. So the snakes are living here. Okay. Let's see if I can put all this together in my head. So they return to Hastinapura. They're rewarded the forest, right? And they decide to clear cut it. The forest is under Indra's protection, hence the name Indraprastha, right? Agni wants it cleared, the fire god. And basically, they work with Agni to clear the forest. Actually, at a certain point, Arjuna fights with Indra over this. And that's his own father that he's fighting against, right? So they clear the forest, right? And the Nagas are all killed, right? Now, there's one Naga who's not there at the time. This is Takshaka, okay? Takshaka is not there at the time. But his wife and his son are killed in the process. And so Takshaka vows revenge on the entire Kuru dynasty because of this. Okay. Fast forward, Sarpameda, the extermination of the snake sacrifice, right? Takshaka is the one who bites and kills Parikshit in this vengeance. He sneaks in the form of a little worm, right? And then on the last day, when Parikshit thinks he's lasted the entire year, and he taunts them, screw you, Nagas, I made it, bring me some food, and on the food is this little worm bites him and kills him, right? So this is why, this is kind of the fulfillment of Takshaka's vendetta for them clearing the Pandava forest. So he kind of just hates all the Kuru kings equally. And this, you know, remember, these guys are descendants of Arjuna, so, you know, he takes his revenge out on poor little Parikshit, right, who ends up dying from that. Okay, so Asura Maya survives. Maya is he's like kind of an architect, and he helps them build Indraprastha, which becomes this new city, a beautiful, beautiful city with some of the best architecture in the world. They also enlist other architects from the gods as well, too. And this creates like a Cold War sort of tension between Hastinapura and Indraprastha. Now you have two, you know, polarized teams, right? And there's just kind of like this impending conflict that everybody knows is going to happen, right? Okay, so at a certain point, Duryodhana, remember, bad guy, he decides to go and visit Indraprastha, right? And he gets really badly insulted. So this becomes part of, you know, this is just another thing that enrages Duryodhana, right? So he goes into this giant hall that's been built by Maya. And he gets tricked. You know, the architecture is so amazing that there's like this kind of like illusionist sort of thing going on, which is kind of what Maya means, right? So at one point, like, these maids appear from behind the wall, and he's like, how did that happen? And at a certain point, he looks at the solid granite floor, and he sees it ripple, and he's like, oh, it's water, right? And then at another point, he steps on the solid granite floor. Sorry, he sees what he thinks is water, and it ends up being solid. And he sees what he thinks is solid, and he falls in it, and he splashes in it. And at this point, Draupadi says something really, really insulting. She says, "Andhika putra andha," right? The son of the blind man's son is blind. So she insulted him and his daddy. Right? So Duryodhana is enraged, right? He's really pissed, right? So this becomes, and at this point he's like, we need to do something. We need to get this Cold War hot, you know? And so he leaves very, very angry, right? Okay, so part of what Yudhishthira has now that he's built this beautiful new city, Indraprastha, he has to consecrate himself as the king, or has to be consecrated as the king. So what they do is a Rajasuya ritual. This is a Vedic ritual where basically collect tribute from all the local kingdoms, right? They all basically come and they pay tribute and they, in a sense, accept your domination, right? So all the kings are there, except Jarasandha. Okay, now who the heck is Jarasandha? Jarasandha, okay. Jarasandha, it means like half. Sandha means like split. Jartha is a Rakshasi. So basically what happens is his father didn't have any children, went to a rishi. The rishi said, here, take this piece of fruit and feed it to your wife, and she'll become pregnant, and she'll have a son. And he takes it, and then he's like, oh, wait, I have two wives. So he cuts the piece of fruit in half, gives one to each wife. Each wife gives birth to half a son. And this kind of abomination comes out, and he's like, oh, what is this? Oh, my goodness, discard it. Go throw it in the forest, right? You know, and what happens is this Rakshasi comes along. Her name's Jara, right? And she comes along and she finds half a dude over here, half a dude over here, puts them together, and woo, we have a whole guy, right? And that's kind of the birth of Jarasandha, right? Okay. Now Sandha, excuse me. Jarasandha now has an alliance with the big bad dude Kamsa. So another background to Krishna's story is that he's in some places it says that he's reborn here to exterminate this evil Kamsa guy, who's part of this whole problem, right? Okay, so Kamsa, his father is King Ugrasena, right? This goes into the whole story of Krishna's youth. A soothsayer comes to King... first of all, actually, Kamsa does a coup against his father, King Ugrasena, and he's helped by Jarasandha. Right? So Jarasandha has assisted Kamsa in his coup against his father. Kamsa comes to power, and he's just like this jerk, this total tyrant, right? He's messing all kinds of stuff up, right? And a soothsayer comes to him and says, your sister's going to have a kid, he's going to be born, and he's going to kill you. And he says, uh-oh, you know, what am I going to do? So he decides that he's going to take his sister, Devaki, and he's going to hide her away, right, with her husband Vasudeva, right, kind of stick them away, right, and then every time they have a kid, he's going to kill them, right, and so again, 8 kids are born, 7 of them are exterminated, and the 8th one,
6 actually,
6, is it 6 and 7?
The 7th was miscarried, and anyway, it's complicated.
Krishna's the 8th,
yeah.
Krishna's the 8th, so anyway, Krishna being the 8th one, basically he gets carried away by his father and dropped off in another village where he's raised, and this whole other thing happens. But the point that's relevant here is that Jarasandha helped Ugrasena with this coup, right? And also another tie that Jarasandha has to Kamsa is that Jarasandha has actually given his daughters to Kamsa. So they're kind of like aligned through wedding as well, too, right? And then, so this is kind of how that all happens. So basically, Jarasandha, or Krishna comes to, he goes and he kills, he comes to age, and he goes and he kills Kamsa, right? He kills him in a wrestling match. And at this point, Jarasandha is enraged and is mad at Krishna for doing this, because this is his buddy that he helped come to power by overthrowing his father, and he's also the guy who he's given his daughters to, and now his daughters are widows. So Jarasandha is angry with Krishna for doing this. So back to Yudhishthira's Rajasuya, his consecration ritual, basically before this can happen, what Yudhishthira says is because Jarasandha is not willing to pay tribute, Krishna advises Yudhishthira that before he can do his proper Rajasuya ritual, that they need to actually go kill Jarasandha, right? And now Jarasandha is doing this yajna, this ritual. This is all very confusing, I know. He's doing this ritual where he's got to sacrifice 100 kings, kill them, you know, blood ritual. He's got 95 of them. These 95 kings have actually petitioned Krishna for help. So Krishna goes there with Bhima. Bhima kicks his butt and kills him. Rips him in half, because remember he was two pieces before. And Bhima finds it out, rips him in half, throws, and I think they keep coming back together, but he rips him in half and the two pieces come back together, rips him in half, two pieces come in, and then finally he realizes if he rips him in half and throws one on one side and the other on the other side, then they can't come back together. And so that's how Jarasandha dies, right? So, anyway, that's the whole thing. But actually, that story is much more complicated because it kind of touches on the whole Kamsa Krishna dynamic, which is way more complex than I want to go on. So now this Rajasuya can happen, right? Jarasandha is dead. Everybody's going to pay tribute, right? And at this point, Shishupala enters the circus. This is all very confusing. So these stories, they just overlap and they intermesh. And it's like, again, like I said, understanding one story is one thing, but to understand 20 of them and then to understand how they all relate to each other, that's where you start getting screwed up, right? So Shishupala is born. He's there's a prediction that he's born as a mutilation. He has extra arms and I think an extra eye. And there's a prediction that whoever lap he sits on and the mutilation disappears, that will be the person that kills him. Lo and behold, when he's a kid, he sits on Krishna's lap and his mutilations disappear. And I think his mother is Krishna's aunt and begs Krishna, don't kill my son, don't kill my son. And Krishna says, well, I will let him insult me 100 times, right? But on the 101st, I'll kill him. You know, so he can insult me 100 times. But on the 101st, he's dead. Okay. Now, Shishupala hates Krishna. Why does Shishupala hate Krishna? Because of Rukmini, right? Okay, so Rukmini is Rukmini's brother, right? He's best friends with Shishupala, right? Shishupala is supposed to marry Rukmini. So Rukmini sets up his best friend with his sister, right? He's like, I'm going to set up my best friend with my sister. It's going to be awesome, right? But Rukmini doesn't really want to marry Shishupala. And she wants to marry Krishna. So Shishupala hates Krishna because of this, right? Because basically, in a sense, Shishupala got dumped for Krishna, I guess is the way to put this, right? So Shishupala now hates Krishna. And again, remember the prophecy is that Krishna is going to ultimately kill him, right? So now at the Rajasuya of Yudhishthira, they're trying to decide who's going to be the most honored guest here, right? And Bhishma's like, Krishna, he's the Supreme Lord after all, right? And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, wait a minute here. And then this long discourse follows about how great Krishna is and how he's the Supreme Lord and he's a great God and he's all of these things. And it's kind of like, we kind of knew that, but the other characters didn't really know that. So this becomes like this kind of outing of Krishna, sort of, so to speak, right? And Shishupala is just not having this, right? Shishupala's like, no, that's the guy who that woman dumped me for, you know, whatever. So he stands up and he just starts insulting Krishna. It's really fun stuff to read, though, because I mean, it's literally pages and pages and pages of insults. And you know, Krishna's sitting there, dropping his fingers, and like, okay, waiting for that. 101 rolls around, whoosh, busts out the chakra and cuts his head off, right? And he's dead. And then all of a sudden, his spirit goes out of his body and joins into Krishna. And it's like, ooh, that's weird, right? Well, it turns out, I don't know if I have it out here. They have history together. Basically, he was one of the guards of Vishnu's heaven, who is... He had a choice to either be born as Krishna's friend 7 times or Krishna's enemy 3 times. And if he chose it 3 times, then Krishna would kill him. So technically, they're actually friends in this heavenly realm, but he chose to be born as his enemy, so he gets killed and gets liberated from his body. I know, it's really overwhelming and hard to follow. And so what happens is, so basically, this is the last time that he's been liberated. So one of the things that Shishupala mentions here is worth mentioning, right? So when Shishupala is standing here insulting Krishna, he doesn't remember that he's supposed to be killed in this heavenly way, but one of the things that he says some very curious things. He says, you know, Krishna, you think he's this big god, but, you know, what does he do? He doesn't do anything. So what? He picked up a mountain. Big deal. So what? He killed a stork. Big deal. So what? He killed a python. This guy's a cow killer. He killed a cow, and he's a woman killer, right? And then the story just dropped. Like, you know, we don't know what this is referring to, right? What is this story? So later, after Mahabharata kind of becomes composed, there's a appendix called Hari Vamsa, right? Like, literally means the lineage of Vishnu, Hari, right? And this kind of hashes out the stories a little bit better, right? So what happens is after Mahabharata comes around, I guess if you think about the reception, is like, oh yeah, this is a really great story. We love to hear about Krishna, this awesome god, but what did he do when he was a kid? What happened before he entered the story there at Draupadi Swayambara, right? And somebody picked up on this and was like, oh, well, look, there's these things here. And then they kind of, I guess if you want to think from a literary perspective, and less of a devotional perspective, you can think they reverse engineered and said, oh, well, let's, you know, figure out what these stories are. And so the Hari Vamsa goes is a later addition to the Mahabharata. It becomes like the appendix where they tell the story of Krishna's pastimes as a kid and how he picked up the Govardhan Mountain, how he was attacked by these various different asuras which were sent by Kamsa, and basically he kills them all. You know, this demoness comes to poison him with breast milk and all of these things. And these are first, we hear these first with Shishupala's criticism. So these stories that later become the Bhagavata Purana, in the Bhagavata Purana, are first mentioned here, then they're later elaborated in the Hari Vamsa, and then later they become Bhagavata Purana. And it's also interesting to note that here in Hari Vamsa, we don't have Radha. No Radha, right? It's just Krishna and all his gopis, but our little Radha is missing. Okay, Rana.
Is that kind of how all, you know, how it's so convoluted and there's all the stories? I was curious, you know, how is it that so many stories came in, and a lot of it sounds like is to then go back and answer why things are the way they are.
Yeah, this is probably written by tens of thousands of people over thousands of years. I mean, really, it's like there's a story, and somebody adds to it, and somebody adds to it, and the poets, and the authors, and the commentators, everybody is like looking for something where there's a hole in the story, where they're going to fill in that hole. You know, what's the backstory, what's the back? So again, what you end up doing is you end up creating a universe, right? I mean, if you think about just how complex this room is right here, every one of you guys has got a story and a backstory and a story and a backstory. I mean, it looks like a room full of people, but this is actually a really incredible clash of stories. And if I was to try to tell this story, I'd be sitting here with the laser pointer for 6 hours doing what I'm doing here, you know? And that's kind of, it's a really fascinating process because the Mahabharata becomes this universe, this kind of like sub-universe. And you can get lost in there, and part of me is still lost in there.
That's what's amazing. It all was inscribed somewhere to where it came down to you.
It was largely an oral tradition. These suttas, you remember the caste that Karna is supposedly of. These suttas are like charioteers, but they're also bards. So really, the way it's envisioned is that these suttas ride around with their heroes on the charioteers. They watch everything that their hero does, and then they go sing the stories of like. He was great, Sir Robin. And that's kind of, and that's what the sutta does, right? You know, that guy was a sutta, right? They got the coconut shells as a sutta. And then they get become composed, and then they go and tell them in taverns, not taverns, but they tell them in public places, going into Europe now, but they're going to they tell them in public places, and then they feel the audience response. You know, they're like, okay, well, that part of the story didn't really fly. We'll just drop that. Oh, people are really responding to this, like, you know, this. You know, this is why some of this stuff is so crazy and shocking, because it's like, that's what the audience responded to. That's what stuck, you know. And that's just how this stuff really becomes composed. And like I said, it's, you know, thousands of years and millions of people, and who knows? I mean, just what goes into this is just absolutely phenomenal. You know, it's not somebody sitting down saying, hey, I'm going to tell a really good story. You know, it's literally the mind and the culture responding to cultural needs, responding to the norms of the society. I mean, there's just so much that goes into it. It's infinitely complex, right? So now our friend Duryodhana has been insulted by Draupadi, and he's pissed. And he wants revenge, right? Shakuni. I would say if there's one villain in this entire story, somebody who's unequivocally bad, I would say it's Shakuni, okay? Shakuni says to Duryodhana, he says, I know how we can fix those guys. We're going to have a dicing game, right? It turns out that Shakuni is a very skilled dicer, right, for a set of reasons. So who's Shakuni? Shakuni is the brother of Gundari, Dhritarashtra's devout wife who's wearing the blindfold. Right? Very, very, very powerful woman. You know, at one point, Yudhishthira, after the war, begs for her forgiveness, and he, like, you know, drops down to her feet, and the little crack under her, blindfold, she sees his fingertips and scorches his fingertips. I mean, this is the strength that she has from this tapas, this austerity of blindfolding herself has made her very, very strong, you know. At another point, she has Duryodhana. She says, come visit me naked, right? And at which point, she takes off her blindfold, and everything she looks on his body will become impervious, right? But Krishna has tricked Duryodhana and said, no, you can't go in front of your mom naked. You got to wear something to cover yourself up. And it turns out that he covers his thighs, which leads to his death. Anyway, Shakuni. It's a story tied to a story tied to a story tied to a story. That's just what it is, you know. This is not really. I mean, I suppose there's a beginning and an end, but it's just infinitely complicated. Okay, so, and that's what I like about it. It's kind of fun. It really is, you know. But it's hard to read. I mean, this stuff is, when you read this stuff, you're constantly going like, who is that person again? Who is that person again? How did I describe it to Jim the other day? I said, Mahabharata, worse than Tolstoy. Right? So Shakuni is the brother of Gundari, right? So he's the uncle to Duryodhana, the maternal uncle, right? He's angry at Bhishma, so he's got a lot of anger to a lot of people in this. He's mad at Bhishma because Bhishma is the one who set up Gundari, his sister, with this blind guy. And he's like, I guess, somehow humiliated, insulted, angry about this. And so he's mad at Bhishma for this. So first and foremost, he's pissed at Bhishma. Secondly, this is a story I don't know. They find out Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana find out that Gandhari was previously married to a goat. Can't find the story. But I'm sure there is one. Yeah, I can't find the story for the life of me, but one of the versions here is that they find out that she was previously married to a goat, and they get really pissed, and they're like, we're going to imprison her whole family. We're going to take Gandhari's whole family, we're just going to throw him in the dungeon, because, you know, how dare she marry Dhritarashtra when she was married to a goat before? I don't know how this works. I mean, we were reading something, and we came across, what was it, Indra's goat. That's the only goat I can think of in the literature, but I can't, anyway, so I don't know that story. But, however, they all get thrown in prison, right? And they're basically starving, and they're fed like something like one grain of rice a day, right? And they're all sitting here with this one grain of rice, and all of the family members decide that they're going to take their grain of rice and they're going to give it to one family member who can survive and enact revenge on the family who's done this to them. So they all save up their piece of rice and they give it to Shakuni day after day. And so Shakuni lives, and he wants revenge on the whole thing. So this is an interesting thing. On the surface, Shakuni is on this Kaurava side. Shakuni is the main advisor to Duryodhana. He's the guy who's whispering in Duryodhana's ear and inflaming his jealousy and anger and everything else. But he's actually technically got a vendetta against not just Duryodhana, but his entire line. So this becomes a very, very complex situation where, you know, Duryodhana is listening to the wrong guy, really, you know. And just to, so that I know I've said it, Duryodhana's three main advisors are Shakuni, Karna, remember the Sutta keeps getting discriminated against, and then his brother Dushasana. Right? Okay, so those are the people he listens to, and he ignores Bhishma, and he ignores Drona, and he ignores Vidura. So that's kind of how the core is, the Republicans and Democrats of Hastinapura. You know, you got the righteous Drona, Bhishma, and Vidura who are being ignored by Duryodhana, and then you got these kind of sleazy characters, Dushasana, Shakuni, and Karna, who's not sleazy, but is just he's a righteous guy who just happens to be taking his righteousness on the wrong person. You know, it's an interesting. That's what we love about Karna. He's this amazingly righteous guy who just happened to fall in the wrong. You know, he's loyal, but he's loyal to the wrong guy. Anyway, so Shakuni says. So Shakuni actually has a set of dice that are made from his father's bones. And whatever number he thinks when he rolls them, that's the number that's going to come up. So Shakuni's like, we can kick these guys' ass at some dice. Get them down here. Let's have a dice game. So they build up this whole structure. They decide to have this dicing tournament. And Yudhishthira, on the one hand, he kind of fancies himself as something of a gambler, right? Like he's a good gambler. But on the other hand, as a kshatriya, he can't turn down his challenge. As a warrior, it's against his honor if he's been challenged to turn down the challenge. So he feels impelled to dice. And throughout this whole episode, these guys are constantly bemoaning fate. You know, like Dhritarashtra is like, it was just fate. It was just fate. At one point, Vidura is like, yeah, it was fate, but it was your fate. If you hadn't let your son manipulate you, none of this would have happened, right? So here, Yudhishthira kind of is just like, oh, well, it's fate. I got to go. And this is the reason, one of the reasons why Yudhishthira keeps losing at the dice game is because he feels like whenever he's challenged, he has to respond, and that's just dharma, and that's what he's given, and that's what he has to do. So there's kind of like almost this sort of deferring of personal accountability, you know, because you have the set of rules, you're given something, you just respond based on the rules, right? And it may not lead you to a good spot. So they build the dicing hall, and then, of course, Shakuni decided, they have Shakuni play for Duryodhana against Yudhishthira. Right? They bet everything. They start with the money, lose the money. They start with the horses, the elephants, the cows, lose the horses, the elephants, the cows. Then they start, you know, real estate, lose the real estate. Basically, he just goes down the line, and every time, you lose, you lose, you lose. And Shakuni actually is saying, I win every time. And he's taking the whole thing, you know. And finally, he gambles his brothers. You know, he loses everything else. So he's like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to gamble my brother. So he gambles Nakula and Sahadeva. Bhima loses Arjuna, right? And then his brothers are gone. And he says, okay, well, I gamble myself. So the implication here is that you're going to be a slave now. And his brother's going to say, so he gambles himself, loses, right? And then Shakuni says, but you have one thing you did not gamble yet. Draupadi, right? And turns out that Draupadi is on her period, so she's separated, and she's in the Antaraparam, which is the inner chamber, and she's wearing a particular type of garment. I believe she has her hair in a certain way. Like, she's not presentable to public, so to speak. You know, she doesn't want to present herself. So he loses Draupadi as well, too. Dushasana, Duryodhana's little brother, is sent to go get her. First somebody else's, but then finally. And with Draupadi now, Draupadi is an awesome character because she's this very, very vocal, very, very powerful woman, and she's not afraid to yell at her husbands or even to yell at everybody if she sees. So anyway, this scene, Dushasana is sent to go get her, right? She refuses. You know, she says, look, I'm menstruating, I'm wearing my clothes, I cannot be seen in public like this. No, you get out of here. This is. And then she says, who did he lose first, himself or me? And it's kind of like, well, whatever, who cares? No, who did he lose first? Himself or me? Well, he lost himself first, then he lost. Okay. And so basically this this kind of fight ensues, and Dushasana grabs her by the hair and starts to drag her to the court, right? Now, dragging by the hair is, it's considered like a sexual assault, right? So this is kind of a pseudo, I think maybe you could think of it as a displaced sort of rape allegory, if you will. So this I guess would be probably in our culture like grabbing a woman's, you know, rear end or her breast or something, you know, grabbing the hair is like it's on that level, right? And so basically drags her in front of everybody, right? And so the, you know, Duryodhana is all happy, you know, and he's getting kind of a little drunk with power, right? And he starts ordering the Pandavas to disrobe, and then he orders Draupadi to disrobe. And she refuses, of course. And Dushasana goes, and he starts pulling her garments off, right, in front of everybody, right, there, on her moon cycle, no less. You know, this is about the worst thing you can ever do, right? I mean, this is as bad as any rape or type of sexual assault. But magically, the garment just keeps going. And it's this kind of really silly scene where Dushasana is pulling and pulling, and he literally collapses on the floor in exhaustion and just, like, gives up. Alright, okay, so now the later interpretation of this would be that Krishna helped her, right, that she prayed to Krishna. However, Mahabharata doesn't reflect that. The Mahabharata, it just, there's nothing. This is what happened. I suppose the assumption is because she's a righteous woman that she has this kind of power. Later on, she runs into Krishna, and Krishna's like, oh, dude, sorry, I wasn't there to help you. If I was there, I would have stopped it. And she's like, yeah, whatever, you know. And that's kind of how that goes down. So Krishna acknowledges that he wasn't there and he didn't help her. But later it becomes interpreted that she prays to Krishna and that Krishna helped. But the earlier version does not really have that, okay? So basically what happens is, yeah, okay, so Krishna apologizes for not being there. Dhritarashtra at a certain point just kind of like goes, oh my God, this is going too far. And he says, Draupadi, I'm the king around here. I'll give you whatever boons you want. And the first thing she says is, she says, well, it's free Yudhishthira. And he's like, okay, here's another boon. She's like, oh, well, free Arjuna. Okay, here's another boon. You know, he's like trying to get her. Dhritarashtra's like okay with the Pandava. No, he's not really okay, but it doesn't get to a crisis point to Dhritarashtra until he sees Draupadi being humiliated like this. And he wants her to say, I want my freedom back, but she won't do that because Pativratam is the one whose vow is her husband. She keeps thinking of her husband's first. And finally, the whole thing gets undone. And Dhritarashtra says, forget all of this. None of this even happened. You guys just get your stuff and go. Get out of here, right? And so the Pandavas, you know, they all get together and they leave. All right. But,
Mordizing.
The second they leave, Duryodhana's like, Daddy. Because remember, this is Dhritarashtra's main flaw, that he keeps being manipulated, right? He says, Daddy, what do you think those guys are going to do now? You think they're just going to go hang out in Indraprastha and forget this ever happened after Draupadi was humiliated like this? You think these guys are just going to, they're going to come here, they're going to kill everybody, right? They're going to kill me, they're going to kill you, they're going to kill everybody, you know? We got to do something to stop this. He says, this is what we need to do. We'll challenge Yudhishthira to one more match. and it does depict Yudhishthira as being a little bit drunk with the gambling vibe, you know, because this caution of gambling goes all the way back to the Rig Veda. You know, there's a story in the Rig Veda about a gambler who loses everything and is shamed by everyone, and even his wife, you know. And so this is kind of a common motif of this kind of gambling is bad sort of thing. In a sense, Yudhishthira is depicted as thinking he's an awesome gambler, kind of being drunk with the gambling addiction, but also the sense that he's a kshatriya who can't turn down a challenge, right? So Duryodhana says, here's what's going to go on. We're going to have one more match, and whoever is defeated must live in the forest for 12 years. And for the 13th year, they have to live incognito and not be recognized. That's the terms, okay? And guess what? Yudhishthira loses, and they're exiled. So if it wasn't before, now war is inevitable because these guys have literally lost everything and they've been kicked out. And these are powerful guys. I mean, they may not have anything, but they have alliances, they have friends, they have sympathies, you know, they have a rightful claim to the throne. They, you know, so this is a very, very dangerous situation here, okay? That's where I was supposed to get to last week. And now, in the next 45 minutes, we have the Vanaprastha part of that, right? Which this is the forest chapter where these guys are wandering around the forest. They're in exile, right? 12 years. And they're just wandering around. Now, this is kind of the statement in the Mahabharata, whatever is here is somewhere else. Whatever is not here is nowhere else. This Vanaprastha, this Vanaparva becomes a compendium of lore and laws and just a ragtag mix of whatever. You know, there's a story floating around in Indian culture at this time. It gets thrown into Vanaparva, right? So you know, they'll be walking along, and you disturb like, oh, this really sucks, and says something to the sage, hey, have you ever met anybody who sucks as much as I do? And the sage will be like, as a matter of fact, and tell them different stories, right? So all of these stories, all of this lore, all of this stuff just kind of gets kind of jammed in this, like, chapter, or the giant chapter, where these guys are just kind of bumming around the forest and listening to stuff. They go to religious sites, they do all kinds of things like this. Throughout this time, Yudhishthira is just totally feeling sorry for himself, which he kind of does throughout the whole epic. I mean, to be honest, I don't really find Yudhishthira as a very likable character. Well, he's so righteous. I mean, that's cool. He's great. He's an awesome guy. He's a great warrior. But he's always just like, poor me, you know, poor fate did this to me again. And Draupadi's not having it. You know, Draupadi's like, you idiot. And she's not afraid to tell him that. I mean, throughout this, and the way she excoriates the entire court when she's being humiliated. I mean, and she makes the argument that if he lost himself first, then he can't lose her, because he doesn't own himself, and if he doesn't own himself, he can't rightfully own anything, so therefore he doesn't own her, so therefore he couldn't rightfully gamble. So she, I mean, she's powerful, like, she could have been a lawyer, you know? So she's a very, very strong female character, Draupadi is, and as is Sita as well, too. So these, you know, these are not two-dimensional women here, you know? So anyway, you know, and then Bhima's just angry. Bhima's pissed. He's always like, let's go to war. And they're like, no, Dharma, blah, blah. He's like, yeah, let's go to war, you know? So all the allies visit, and, you know, people come visit them while they're in the story. And this is the part where Krishna apologizes to Draupadi for not being there, right? So one of the things that happens in this chapter is Arjuna goes and gets a bunch of weapons. Yudhishthira says, hey, man, go out and get weapons. So he does. He performs austerities in the Himalayas. You know, at one point, Shiva comes down to the earth and acts like a mountain man. They have a big fight. He's awarded weapons by Shiva. He gets weapons from Shiva, but he also gets weapons from a lot of these Vedic gods. Yama, Varuna, Kubera, and Indra, right? So he gets a staff, he gets a noose, he gets all this sort of stuff from all of these Vedic gods, right? And at a certain point, he gets invited up into the heaven with Indra, right? And a very interesting episode happens there, where his great 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 grandmother tries to seduce him while he's up there, which is a story I will tell in just a second. So there's your cliffhanger, right? So anyway, he goes up to Indra's heaven, and he's like visited there. He ends up coming back. So another one of the stories that gets told in here is the story of Nala and Damayanti, in the context where Yudhishthira is just feeling sorry for himself. He says to a sage, you know, I lost everything, I'm in this pathetic... Is there ever a king who's as pathetic as I am? And he says, yeah, let me tell you the story of Nala and Damayanti. Let's see if I can do this in 10 seconds. This was one of the first stories to be translated into European language. It was immensely popular in 19th century Europe. I mean, it was kind of this romantic tale, right, of Nala and Damayanti. Damayanti's having a swan for hour where she's trying to pick a husband. All the gods have heard of how awesome she is and how beautiful they are. They all show up. But she said, from hearing Nala's name, she instantly fell in love with him. And she said she's only going to marry Nala. So all the gods, they basically clone themselves and make them look like Nala. And they go before her and they're like, which one are you going to pick? And she looks at them all and she's like, interesting how none of you guys are touching the ground except for that guy. I'll pick him. Right? So these gods supposedly, like, they list the qualities of the gods, and one of their qualities is that they've never actually touched the ground. So she sees through it. Kali, this kind of like bad god, shows up late. He realizes that he already lost and Nala's married, so he gets angry. He decides to possess Nala's body and causes him to go on a gambling spree in which he loses everything, right? So him and Damayanti, and so this is like the analogy to like, oh yeah, Yudhishthira, you got it pretty bad, but this dude had it pretty bad and it all worked out for him, you know? You'll be okay, Yudhishthira, because look what happened to Nala. Right, so they get exiled to the forest. Out of guilt, he leaves Damayanti. He's like, you know, I shouldn't be dragging around. So he takes off. And basically, at a certain point, he rescues a naga. And the naga's like, here, let me give you a boon. And first thing he does is he turns into a dwarf. And the second thing he does, he bites him. And he's like, oh, thanks. That was awesome. All right, whatever. And it's kind of unclear about why this is a boon at this point. So later on, Nala just kind of stumbling around. His luck just sucks because he's got this kind of like poisonous demon inside of him, right? And he's just stumbling around. Everything sucks for him. And Damayanti wants him back. And she's like, well, I know how to get him back. I'll have a Swayamvara, and I bet he'll show up. Meanwhile, Nala, who's been transformed into this poisoned dwarf, gets a job with a king as the Suta, as the charioteer bard guy, brave Sir Robin dude. And then that king decides, I'm going to go to Damayanti's Swayamvara. They show up, and she recognizes Nala. And all of a sudden, the poison takes effect. He got bitten with the snake. The poison takes effect, kills the demon, or poisons the demon inside of me, throws up the demon, and turns back into Nala, and they're reunited happily ever after. The quickest rendition of Nala and Damayanti ever done. So. Oh shit, there's another story. this is another one that happens in the you know, just gets thrown in here, right? So this is kind of a creation myth about how the ocean gets destroyed. Okay, so there's this king. He's got no sons, and he wants sons, so what does he do? Austerity, right? Shiva comes down and says, here, I'll give you 60,000 sons from one wife and one son from the other wife, right? Wife number one has a son. Wife number two has a gourd, right? She's instructed to plant all the seeds from the gourd in ghee, of course, because it's this magical substance. And from them, the 60,000 sons are born. So now he's this powerful king with all these sons. He's like, I'm going to take over the earth. I'm going to do an Ashvamedha. Okay, Ashvamedha, excuse me. I guess I got to explain the Ashvamedha. So many years ago, I ordered my first copy of the Atharva Veda. I got all the Vedas, and the Atharva Veda comes in the mail. I'm so excited, you know. I've heard so much about Vedic literature, and I can't wait to read it. And I flip it open. The first thing I read is the horse sacrifice. And I was like, what is this? Very anticlimactic moment in my life. The horse sacrifice, A, it's one of the most violent things I've ever read. And B, it's kind of weird. Okay, so basically the idea is this is a royal consecration of power, right? So what they do, the king gets a horse, and the horse wanders around for a year, and wherever that horse steps, that land now belongs to the king, all right? So they reel the horse back in. They do a very, very violent slaughter of this horse, in which point the queen copulates with the horse. It may or may not be a symbolic copulation. We're not really sure. So that's it. So this is one of the ways that you get power as a king in the Vedic world. Okay. Yeah, not unlike Tijuana. What's that? But anyway, it's a strange ritual. That's how it is. That's how it works. So this guy is now Sagara is going to do this to consolidate power. So the horse is wandering around. Indra, the king of the gods, becomes threatened and says, you know, I can't let this happen. I'm going to hide the horse. So he hides the horse underground, right? So Sagara tells his sons, he says, go find my horse. You know, we need to get this horse. So the 60,000 sons are roaming the earth. They can't find it anywhere. They're like, well, I know. He must be underground. So they start get their shovels out and they start digging these trenches. And they come across the sage Kapila, who's hanging out doing his asceticism underground with this horse. And they're like, hey, jerk, you stole our horse. And they basically, like, you know, try to kick his butt and take the horse, right? But turns out this guy's a really powerful ascetic, so he opens his eyes and incinerates them. Whoa. And these piles of ashes, right? And Sargeras like, hey, what happened to my horse? Even though his 60,000 sons are dead. So he sends his other son from the other wife to go get the horse. He's like, go get the horse. So this son is a little bit smarter. He sees Sage Kapila and he flatters him. He's like, oh, you're such an awesome sage. Hey. You know, and the sage is like, oh, you're so cool. Why don't you have a boon or two? And he's like, first, can I have that horse back? And second, I need some water to purify my brothers, right? Because, you know, they've been burned to ashes here, and they're not going to go to heaven unless we purify them with some water, right? And it turns out that Sagara has a great grandson who's performing tapas, Bhagirathata, and he also attains a boon by Ganga, the river goddess, to purify his ancestors. So basically what happens is Ganga comes down to the earth to sanctify Sagara's sons who have been incinerated. But she also realizes that she's going to destroy the earth if she does this, because the force, because you know the Milky Way is the celestial Ganga, right? And she comes down to the earth, but before she can do that, she has to land on Shiva's head. So Shiva offers his head so that the force of celestial Ganga come into the earth, hits his head first, and then drips from his mats, his matted hair, into the ground. And this is what creates the ocean, right? And this is the Sanskrit word for ocean, Sagara, right? So there, that's another story that gets told in this forest chapter, okay? And then there's another one, a story of the Ramayana. So this is where the Mahabharata acknowledges the existence of the Ramayana, which therefore in Ramayana does not know the existence of the Mahabharata, so therefore this is kind of one of our textual proofs that the Ramayana is probably an earlier document. Okay. I like this Mahabharata against the clock. Which did you turn to? How did you get the Jayadratha already? No, okay. Oh, okay, so one of the things that happens here is the subduction of Draupadi. So while they're wandering around in the forest, again, this is comparable to Sita getting abducted by Ravana and the Ramayana. Okay, so Jayadratha is this kind of creepy dude, and he married Drusala, who's the sister of the Kauravas, the only sister. Remember, there's 100 brothers and one sister. So he marries her, right? And one day he's just cruising along the forest, and lo and behold, whoa, there's Draupadi. He doesn't know that it's her. He's like, oh, that's a really hot lady. So he goes up to her and he proposes, like, what do you say? You want to get married? You know, it's the Gandhavar marriage where you can literally be married on the spot, right? And so she's like, no, ick. And he's like, okay, fine, I'll just kidnap you then, you know, because that's a legal marriage. So he grabs her and kidnaps her, and then the Pandavas come back, somebody who witnessed it told them, and the Pandavas go after him, right? They catch him, they bring him back, and they're ready to kill him, and Draupadi's like, you know, actually, he's married to Drusala, and I don't want Drusala to be a widow, so don't kill him, please don't kill him. So instead, they do the only thing that's worse than killing a man, shaved his head. Source of your power, right? Anyway, so shaves his head, kicks him in the butt, and sends him on his way. And what does he do? He says, revenge, right? So he goes to do austerities. Have we seen themes here, right? So that he'll get the power to have the revenge, right? This is kind of so much the way that Draupadi getting pulled by the hair was like a rape allegory, like a sexual assault. The masculine power is in the hair. So this is kind of, you can think of this as like a displaced castration, right? No offense to my bald friends. So that's kind of how that works. So it's considered, well, these are mostly kshatriyas. So the kshatriyas are supposed to have long hair, right? Not everybody does, obviously. But so that's what happens. So he goes and he does his tapas, vowing for revenge, and Shiva comes down, as Shiva's prone to do, and says, what do you want? And he says, well, I want to kill the Pandavas who did this to me. Now they humiliated me, shaved my head, bunch of jerks. And he says, well, you know, Shiva, knowing righteousness, knowing dharma, says, I'm not really going to do that because those guys are good guys, but I'll give you a garland and it will keep them at bay. It will hold them off for one day. So if they're ever trying to kill you, you can hold them at bay for one day. Okay, this becomes very important later on. It's not enough for him. So he goes to his daddy, who's this famous sage, and he says, Daddy, Daddy, help me kill these guys. And Daddy's like, no, because his dad's like, no, I don't want to be the guy who like is responsible for the Pandavas die. But he says, I'll give you another boon. Whoever kills you, whoever causes your head to fall on the ground, their head will explode into 1,000 or 100 pieces, right? Okay, so later on in the war, Jayadratha helps kill Abhimanyu, Arjuna's son. Arjuna vows revenge. He says, I'm going to kill that guy by the end of the day tomorrow, or I will commit suicide myself. The entire Kaurava Arma protects Jayadratha because they realize that if they can protect him, Arjuna is going to be dead, and that's going to be awesome. But Arjuna's just fighting his way through the troops, and he looks up at the sky, and Krishna looks up at the sky, and it's like, man, we ain't going to make it. So what does Krishna do is he throws his chakra up in front of the sun and creates an eclipse, and the whole world goes dark. And Jayadratha, he's kind of a jerk. He's kind of a hothead. So right when it gets dark, he goes up to Arjuna and he's like, neener, 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 you didn't kill me. And then all of a sudden, Krishna moves the chakra and whoosh, whoosh. But Krishna says, before you kill him, you got to hit him with an arrow that's going to take his head and drop it in his daddy's lap. So the head flies. It doesn't hit the ground. Because remember, it did. Arjuna's head would blow up. And it lands in daddy's lap. Daddy's sitting here meditating like this. And something lands in his lap and he jumps up. And his son's head falls on the floor, and bam, his head explodes. So, That's how it goes down with Jayadratha. So anyway, the reason I'm telling the story is because Jayadratha has history in this this Vana part of the story because he's in Astropathy. Okay, so that's how he dies. Okay. Another thing that happens in this forest story is one of the first three Dharma tests. Yudhishthira is constantly being tested by his daddy. Remember, his daddy is Dharma, right? Even though his earthly daddy's Pandu, who didn't actually... Anyway, you get this picture. So Dharma's constantly... His father, Dharma, is constantly testing him, right? So at one point, they're all like... You know, they're living kind of a wretched life, you know, in the forest. It's a hard place to live. And so he sends Nakula, one of the twins. He says, go get some water, man. We're dying over here. And actually, I'm kind of, too. Thanks.
Sure.
So since Nakula, this story's gonna make you thirsty if I don't drink something. Sends Nakula to get some water, and Nakula goes up to this lake, and he's like, awesome, a lake, and he goes to stick his head in the lake, and this voice of a yaksha comes up and says, answer my questions before you drink. And he's like, whatever, and drinks, falls dead. Second brother goes looking for him, same thing. Third brother goes looking for him. Fourth brother goes, they all go and they die, right? And finally, thank you. Yudhishthira is like, what happened to all my brothers? So he goes to find his brothers and he finds them all dead. And he goes to quench his thirst and hears the voice. And he answers the questions. Right? And the voice then says, okay, so you now have a boon. What is your boon? And he says, I want Nakula to come back to life. He says, Nakula? He says, yeah, I want Nakula to come back to life. He's like, don't you want Bhima or Arjuna? Because these guys are so awesome. Nakula and Sahadeva don't really do anything, a whole story. They just kind of like, I don't know, little minor roles. They're not even your, they're only your half-brothers. You know, they're not daughters, they're not sons of Kunti. Don't you want one of your full brothers? And he's like, no. Because I'm alive, that'll be okay for Kunti. But I don't want all of Madri's kids to be dead. So I want my little brother to be alive, so that Madri can have a kid, and so that Kunti can have a kid. So each mother gets a kid. And all of a sudden, the voice reveals himself to be Dharma, and says, you have passed the first Dharma test. And it's like, okay. So it's kind of this strange little thing. We'll get to our other Dharma tests in a second. But, you know, so that's another thing that happens in this forest story, okay? What's that? No, sorry. And then he says, as a boon, we're going to bring all the brothers back to life, and now everybody's happy. Because, you know, he's Dharma. He's not really in just, like, kill the brothers, right? Okay. So, now we're at the Virata Parvan. So, all this stuff happens in this forest Parvan. Now they have that 13th year where they've got to live incognito, and they can't be discovered, or else they never get anything back, you know? So, basically, 13th year happens, and they decide to go to King Virata and go... get jobs and live incognito, right? I mean, it's kind of hard to do for these guys because they're like, you know, heroes and everything. So they all apply for positions at Virata's court, right? Yudhishthira is like, hey, I'm the gambling master. I'll be your dice master. And he gets a job as the dice master. That's not ironic.
He actually learns dice when he heard the story.
Yeah. So he does learn it. So he is a good dice player at this point. But there's still a certain irony to that. It's not humor. So then Bhima gets a job as being like a cook slash a gladiator because he's this big tough guy, but he's also a fraudera. He loves food. He's always eating, so he's kind of like this cook, right? And he's always sneaking food off to his family. Nakula and Sahadeva, they get jobs in the stables, working with the horses, etc. And then Draupadi, she gets this kind of position as this low caste domestic help for the queen. So she's like this maid to the queen. Okay. Now Arjuna's story is cool. So Arjuna gets a job as a eunuch. and that's a job. Yeah, it's a very prestigious position, you know. so he's Rihannala, right? This eunuch, okay. And the eunuch is a hairdresser and a dance teacher, right? stereotypical, I suppose. And then, so he teaches princes. I happen to have been a dance teacher, okay? No, but I do my wife's hair. So he teaches Virata's daughter, Uttara, how to dance. So he becomes her dance teacher, right? This is a result of Urdhvashi's curse. Remember back when he was in Indra's heaven and he gets propositioned by his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother? So what happens is... he turns her down. She's this hot opsera. I remember she's not aging. She's these celestial maidens, these opseras, and they're just these, like, beautiful women, and they're just immortally, and they're there to entertain the gods and all of this. And so she's, you know, she sees Arjuna, and she's like, that's a nice hunk of man. And she's like, what do you say, Arjuna? And he's like, whoa, you're my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. And she's like, well, screw you, jerk. Because of that, you're going to be a eunuch. And Indra's like, wait a minute, that's my son, you know. But once, of course, you've spoken the curse, you can't take it back. It's like, you know, come on, you know, Urvasi, can you just, like, you know, chill out a little bit? And she's like, okay, he'll be a eunuch for a year, right? And so this is a result of that curse, right? I'm not going to go through the lineage of why she's his great-great-great-grandmother, though that's a very interesting story. I spent an entire semester tracing the story of Urvasi with my professor, but I'm not going to even mention that anymore. Okay, so there's this Kichaka episode that's happening. So Draupadi is working for the queen, right? The queen is jealous of her and is scared that she's going to take her husband away, right? So she kind of, like, sends her brother. She's like, you know, hey, brother, why don't you go, like, marry her or something so she doesn't take my husband away? And I mean, this is a real fear because, you know, like, look at what always happens is the older wife always gets forgotten for the younger wife, you know? This is like Hekai and Ramayana. This is Madri, and, you know, so this is kind of this constant thing that happens is, you know, the older wife is always the first wife. She's powerful. She's got say. She's got clout. But then the husband just kind of forgets about her, you know? So she's afraid this is going to happen with Draupadi, so she sends her brother out, Kichika, right? So Kichika is the brother of the queen, right? And basically, so he goes to proposition Draupadi, who's incognito in this disguise, and she says, whoa, you don't want that. She says, I have 5 Gandhara. Gandharas are these kind of like celestial beings, right? I have 5 Gandhara husbands, right?
Gandharva,
excuse me. And they are, yeah, I guess I spelled it wrong here, huh? So they're gonna mess you up if you keep messing with them. But it doesn't stop them. So he constantly harasses her and assaults her, basically. And she's really upset, and who she complains is Bhima. Bhima and Draupadi have this very, 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 very tight relationship. And Bhima has a very special affection for Draupadi. And he does not like people messing with Draupadi, right? So basically what happens is he's like, okay, here's the plan. Bhima says, I'm going to dress up like a woman. And I'm going to go lay in a bed. We're going to set up this place with a bed. And I'm going to go lay in this bed. And you tell Kichika to go meet me at this bed, okay? And Draupadi's like, that's a great idea. So she goes and does it. So Kichika comes out and goes to the bed, and he starts stroking Bhima's hair and says, feeling his thigh, saying romantic things to him, and all of a sudden it's comic, right? And all of a sudden Bhima's like, it's Bhima, and whips him in half, you know, kicks his butt, right? But beats him to a pulp, I think is what it literally says. Just beats him to death, right? And of course this gets around to the court. Everybody's like, I think that lady is responsible for it. And they blame Draupadi, right? And they want her to kill herself on his funeral pyre, right? Which is kind of something that's expected of wives if they are really a pativratam, right? So Draupadi is kind of this symbol, right? She's a custodian. So one of the things that's difficult to understand in some of these cultures is when women become a custodian to a man's honor, right? This is what happens with honor killings and things like this. The man's honor is that he's a pati. And pati means like a protector of the woman. And if something happens to the woman, I suppose you're upset that something happened to your sister, mother, whatever, etc. But you're actually upset because that defaced your own honor. And so therefore you have to do something about it, right? So in this sense, you know, Draupadi is kind of like this. She's a symbol of kind of, in a sense, what happens when the husbands fail, right? And she's blamed for the war, you know, like there's kind of almost this underlying current that because the husbands didn't do a proper job protecting Draupadi, so to speak, or because Draupadi was humiliated in this way, this entire catastrophic war comes out of this. So keep your women protected is kind of the subtext here, right? So anyway, this is just kind of, you know, some of the connotation that Draupadi's entire story has in this whole thing, right?
She didn't actually immolate herself.
Who? No, absolutely she did not. She
didn't
immolate herself. She didn't climb on the funeral pyre. Bhima shows up and basically kills everybody who's at that funeral. Yeah, he's like, no, you're not going to do that, you know. And so Bhima comes and kicks everybody's butt. Okay, so at the end of the Virata Parvan, right, again, the Kauravas come and they're attacking Virata. They have a suspicion that the Pandavas are hiding out there, right? And they do this, it's cattle raiding season. Remember, these nomadic pastoralists, there's a certain season where kings go steal each other's cattle, right? Cattle raiding. It's kind of like a counting coup almost. Like, it's a way of, you know, you stole their cattle, you kind of are, they're submissive to you, they're subservient to them. And of course, if somebody steals your cattle, you better go do something about that, you know? So there's this kind of whole thing. And so the Kauravas show up to steal the cattle, and Virata's out of town. Virata's out of town, the king's out of town, and his little son Uttara's around, and he's like this kind of immature guy who's like braggart. He's like, oh, kick their butts! And Draupadi's like, you better take the eunuch with you, just in case you need help. So Arjuna gets in the chariot, and Uttara goes to face them, and at a certain point, Uttara breaks down, and he cries, and he's like, I can't do this, I don't want to fight. And Arjuna, chakvotishtam, right, stand up and fight, you know, abandon this, this, you know, and it's coming from a eunuch, right, this cowardice, you know. And basically, this foreshadows the Bhagavad Gita, this is like the pre-Gita, because what happens later on is Arjuna doesn't want to fight. And Krishna uses a lot of the same rhetoric to him that he then previously uses on Uttara, right? Arjuna says, "Don't worry, I'm not really a eunuch. I'm actually Arjuna," and pulls off his silk and whatever else he's wearing, and says, "Take me over there. We're gonna get the weapons." He gets his bow, single-handedly holds off the entire Kaurava force. The Kaurava force says, "You know what? There's only one person who could do that. That's Arjuna." But guess what? It's the last day. Where does it say that? Last day. So it's okay. So then they fight, right? It's why I say, so the Kauravas leave, and the last day of the curse. Last day of the curse. Or not the curse, the agreement from the dicing match, okay? Remember, so...
The last day of
Having to hide. So they don't have to stay hiding anymore. So, you know, perfect timing, right? So basically what happens is Virata learns of their identity. Is like, hey, you guys are awesome. I love him. Big fan. Here, why don't you marry my daughter? Arjuna. And Arjuna's like, you know what, I was her dance teacher, and that kind of makes me like her father, but I will set her up with my son, Abhimanyu, right? So that's how Abhimanyu and Uttara get together and have a party.
Shit.
Okay, so now we have the preparation for war, Parvan, right? So basically what happens is there's formations of alliances, diplomatic envoys are getting sent back and forth. Nobody knows what side Krishna's going to be on, so Duryodhana and Arjuna rush to Dwarka to meet Krishna. Krishna's sleeping. They both enter at the same time. Arjuna respectfully walks up to his feet. Duryodhana, cocky and arrogant, walks up to his head. Krishna opens his eyes and sees Arjuna at his feet, looks up and sees Duryodhana at his head, and Duryodhana says, according to custom, I got here first. You have to grant me my wish first. And he says, well, technically I saw Arjuna first. So I will give him, plus he's younger, so we're going to give him the wish first. And they're like, we want to know which side you're on. And Krishna says, well, tell you what. One of you guys can have my army, the other one can have me. All right? And Duryodhana's like, army. And Arjuna's like, you. And it's just very easily settled, right? And so he becomes, and he says, oh, and he says, and I vow I will not fight in the war. I promise I won't fight, okay? So then Krishna is now on the side of the Pandavas, you know, he's committed to it. He does a diplomatic envoy to Duryodhana, or to the Hastinapura and Duryodhana. At a certain point, what happens is Duryodhana decides to attack him. He actually reveals his divine form for the first time. Shows him, he's all the Vedic gods come out of him, you know, and he shows Duryodhana, he's like, oh, you're going to get me, Duryodhana. Okay, well, look at who I am. Bam. And so this is where the first time you see Krishna's cosmic form, he reveals himself to Duryodhana first. Which is really interesting, because even later on, Duryodhana actually prays to Krishna, which is another side story. So basically, the diplomacy fails. He goes and tells Karna who his real relationship is. That's when he says, hey, Karna, all you gotta do is talk to Yudhishthira. You'll be the king. This whole war will be off. Karna says, nope. My buddy's Duryodhana. He's the one guy who did not discriminate against me. And so the whole war is on, and it's going to go. After Krishna goes to Karna, then Kunti goes to Karna and she begs him. She says, you can't go to war against your brothers. You're the brother, you know? And Karna says, I'll tell you what. He's really mad at Arjuna, right? He says, I'll tell you what. By the end of this, since you only wanted 5 sons anyway, you abandoned me, remember? Since you only wanted 5 sons anyway, by the end of this, you're going to have 5 sons, right? I won't kill any of my brothers, but I'm going to try to kill Arjuna. So either I will die or Arjuna will die, right? But whatever the case is, you will still have the 5 sons that you wanted, you know. And, you know, it's kind of his way of giving his mom a big middle finger, right? and so, you know, obviously we have Bhishma, Drona, Vidura, the karmic guy, the dharmic guys are saying, don't fight, don't war, just give them some land, make it all work. And then you have Duryodhana ignoring all his teachers and listening to Karna, Dushasana, and Shakuni, right? So he's listening to these bad guys, okay? They install generals. Bhishma becomes the general of the Kaurava force. They go off to Kurukshetra, the field where they're going to have the battle. Balarama becomes like a conscientious, Krishna's brother, becomes like a conscientious objector. He's like, I'm not into this whole thing, I'm out of here, see you guys later. Right, he does come back a little bit later. And then they sit down and they talk about rules of engagement, right? This is where the issues of Dharma, because they sit down and they pre-agree to what they can and can't do in this conflict. And some of the things you don't do is you don't fight somebody when they come out of their chariot, you know, you don't hit somebody below the belt. When there's a two-person fight, only two people fight, you don't jump in with 20 other people, and every one of these rules gets violated, right? Okay.
Okay.
Your fingers warmed up. I'm not going to be as ambitious with the Bhagavad Gita as I thought I was. You know, obviously I'm very inspired by this text. I love this text. I'm committing it to memory right now. I've committed the first three chapters to memory, and I only have 15 more to go.
In Sanskrit, yes.
And I recite it for probably close to 2 hours every morning. So I like the Bhagavad Gita a lot. But I'm going to go through it quickly. So there's various different things. Okay, so what happens is now the two armies are on either side. Arjuna's like feeling all bold. He says to Krishna, who's his charioteer, he says, take me between the two armies. I want to look at my opponents in the face. And he gets out there and he looks, who does he see? He sees his family. He sees his teachers. He sees his kinsmen. And all of a sudden he does like Uttara did earlier. And he drops down and he says, I can't do it. I can't fight. You know? Krishna, Klaibya Masma Gamha Partha Naitatva Yupapadyate Kshudram Hridaya Daudbanyam Chakfu Chista Param Tapaha. Abandon this cowardice. Abandon this. He kind of calls him like a eunuch, you know. This sort of, this again, this affront to Arjuna's manhood, right? He's just abandon this. Stand up and fight. This is not how an Arya, not how a noble person should behave. Where is this coward coming from, you know? Basically, yells at him for his manhood and then goes on to this incredible dissertation. this fantastic, the Bhagavad Gita, I think we can really say, shaped post-Vedic thought. Keep in mind the way I use the term Vedic and the way other people use the term Vedic might be different. I'm using it in the academic sense. In the academic sense, when we talk about Vedic literature, we're literally talking about like the four Vedas, right? When we're talking about post-Vedic thought, we're talking about like post-Upanishadic thought, right? Usually. You know, though we will talk about Upanishadic thought. Modern practitioners will often use the term Vedic as anything that just kind of like can trace far enough back to the Vedas. You know, for example, like the Upanishads are a commentary on the Vedas, and then there's commentaries written on the Upanishads, and then people write commentaries on those Upanishads, and so whatever happens way over here is still Vedic because it kind of traces right back. You know, it's a little too, it's not specific enough for academic purposes, so academics are a little bit more specific about how they talk about the term Vedic. But anyway, they really shaped the Vedic thought, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So I'm going to point out several themes that are happening here that start to come up in the Bhagavad Gita. And this is why the Bhagavad Gita can really be considered as like maybe the seminal work of Hinduism, you know. Maybe even more so than any other text, even the Vedas or the Upanishads or anything else. Because there are these certain themes that arise that lead to, I guess, what you could call devotional Hinduism, you know. Which, you know, the idea of worshiping deities at temples, you know, a lot of that may have come from the Bhagavad Gita, or the Bhagavad Gita, maybe stated more precisely, represents that trend of thought that was happening at this point in Indian history, I think maybe the better way of saying it. So society influences Bhagavad Gita, and it's a dialogical relationship, okay? So themes of the Bhagavad Gita. So one of the things is that it does is it consistently discounts the goals of the Vedic literature. Okay, now notice I said discounts, not discredits. Right? One of the beautiful things about Indian thought and Sanskrit literature is it doesn't have the same pattern of fracturing that a lot of our Western thought does. Western thought, you discredit things. You say, oh, that's wrong, and this is right. You know, but a lot of Indic thought, I call it the third story. Right? Indic thought will take story A, story B, they completely contradict each other, but then they will figure out what story C is to make it so that they all work together now. And this is intellectual growth. I mean, this is mastery and artistry, and it makes it so nothing ever gets discarded. And Indian thought and Sanskrit literature just snowballs and it gets bigger. We've destroyed our intellectual tradition in the West a lot. Not completely destroyed, obviously, but we've had years of, you know, certain groups saying other things are heresy and destroying texts and destroying, you know, if something disagrees with me, I'm going to kill it and exterminate it versus I'm going to try to tell the third story. So this is one of the most beautiful things about Sanskrit literature. So anyway, it's discrediting the goals of the Vedas, you know. Can you look at 242 for me? Yaidam pushpitam vacham plavadantya vipashita vedavadara taparta nanyata stiti vatinaha, right? This is something to the effect of beware of the flowery words of the Vedas.
The ignorant ones proclaim this flowery discourse, Arjuna, delighting in the letter of the Veda and saying there is nothing else.
Yeah, okay, so this is like, you know, one of the ways this is discredited. Then we have Tri gunya vishaya vedan ishtai gunya bhavarjuna nirdvandvas nitya sattvasta nirdyogakshama atmavana, is to say that the Vedas are concerned with material reality. I'm just going to paraphrase that one. That we're more interested in spiritual reality. That is to say, Vedic literature was a reciprocal relationship with divinity, right? You did something for God, you expected something in return. You wanted sons, you wanted cows, you wanted health, you wanted rain, you wanted to go to heaven. That's how it was. Now, post-Vedic thought and like what's happening with the Bhagavad Gita is it's saying, okay, that's cool, that works, it's nice. However, you know, there's something higher than that, right? And this is Atmanyanam, right? The knowing of the self. Finding the kind of, I guess you could say, knowing yourself in itself is a divine process. And this is where the internalization of ritual and things like this start to happen. Okay, so it discounts the desire of the Vedas and the goals of the Vedas as being kind of materialistic, so to speak, and elevates this idea of getting to know the Atma, right? The inside, the self. Okay, so then there's this aesthetic themes that are coming up in the Vedas, again, or in the sort of asceticism, because this is a function of post-Vedic thought. Asceticism wasn't big in the Vedic times, but this is kind of where the rise of asceticism comes from. And you can see also all these themes. Anybody has a problem, what do? Austerity, asceticism, because it gives them power, right? So this is just persistently being, you know, pounded into your head in the Mahabharata, and then also these themes are coming up in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the efficacy of austerities, etc. And then really what's the, I think the main contribution of Bhagavad Gita is this rise of bhakti, devotional love, right? You know, you have these types of yoga, Nami can flip it. You have these types of yoga that are being delineated, you know, they're good, they're great, they're fine, they're awesome, but really the most comprehensive approach to divinity is through devotional love, right? You can do asceticism and get power, you can levitate or whatever, you can do all of that stuff, it's cool, but really, like I said, the best approach is through devotional love to the Lord, right? And so time and time again, he says that. What's happening in the post-Vedic period is the Vedic gods are descending, they're getting losing their popularity, because now these are like the guys who, like, you know, gives Arjuna his noose or something, as opposed to being the supreme lord like Krishna is, right? So there's the rise of the post-Vedic god, which is Krishna, you know, he's the post-Vedic god, and Krishna, Vishnu, Shiva, these guys are all post-Vedic gods, and there's the kind of discounting, again, not discrediting, but the discounting of the Vedic gods, Indra, Soma, Agni, etc., okay? So this rise of bhakti, I had a couple verses, we're not going to get into them. And then also, what comes out of this is this this devotional tradition that becomes one of the hallmarks of Hinduism as opposed to like Vedic thought. It's this idea of like temple worship, puja, the idea of the god returning favors with prasadam, and then darshana, the deity seeing you and being seen by the deity as being a sanctifying force, all of these things. So when Krishna reveals himself to Arjuna, you know, it has a purifying effect on Arjuna because he's in the presence of God, you know. And so this idea of being seen by the deity becomes very, very important. So anyway, one of the things that happens, I guess I just said it, but Arjuna, Krishna reveals, again, like he did to Yudhishthira earlier, he now reveals his divine form to Arjuna. And what does Arjuna say? He says, please, sir, I'm sorry if I ever treated you like my buddy, because they were pals, right? I'm sorry if I ever treated you like my buddy, but could you just go back to how you were? You're kind of freaking me out, you know? And that's basically what Arjuna says, you know? He's like, kind of freaking me out, you know? And, you know, so... basically, so this is where Krishna is really rising as a force, and this is probably leading to, you know, the Bhagavata traditions that happen with the Rishnis and spread out and all this Hindu devotionalism, and it becomes like one of the main hallmarks of Hinduism as opposed to Vedic thoughts. So anyway, that's just touching the Bhagavad Gita. Maybe one day I'll teach a whole workshop, and I'll keep you up till 2 a.m. with the Bhagavad Gita workshop. Okay, so Bhishma Parvan, let me get through all the death here. So this is all death. From here on out, depression, dying, violence, okay? Bhishma.
About the Bhagavad Gita, I'll see how it fits into the story.
Okay, so what happened, the Bhagavad Gita, so the war is about to happen. The armies are on both sides. Arjuna says to Krishna, take me to the battle so I can look at my foes in the face. He realizes they're all his family. He breaks down and he says, I can't do this. I can't fight. And what Krishna does is says, sure you can. Stand up and fight. And he talks him into it. And he basically is like, it's kind of like, you're misunderstanding reality. If you understood reality, you would realize that it's your duty to fight, right? You know, some things he says, Vasamsi Jirnani, Yata Vihayana, Vani Girnati, Nado Parani, Tata Shardinani, Vihaya Jirnani, and so one of the things that he discusses is how reincarnation, how you're not really killing any of these people. They have internal souls. You know, again, this is I consider this to be a dangerous philosophy, because if taken out of its context, you could see how this could lead to sociopathic behavior, right? But in the proper context, it's not that at all. You know, but it's the idea that they're already dead. I've already killed them. You're not really even doing it. You know, I'm God, and they've died already. And plus, they have these eternal souls that are just going to keep going on. He who thinks he's the slayer and he who thinks that he's the slain, both of them are incorrect, because the soul is neither killed nor does it kill, right? And so, again, dangerous philosophy stuff. But at the same time, he's also kind of alluding to his divinity, and he's like, you know what, I'm actually God, and I'm here, and this needs to happen, you know? And again, back to the framing of the earth being overwhelmed by these kshatriyas. So that's where that happens. So basically, this whole discourse is, I guess you could say, Krishna saying to Arjuna, look, dude, you're misapprehending reality here. Let me tell you how it is, and then you're going to... And then in the end, Arjuna is basically a convert, I guess you could say, and he's like, yeah, let's go fight, and then they go. All right, so that's how that happens. So the war proceeds from that point. So that's where that all happens. So it's just amazing. I think it's the only religious text in the entire world that happens on a battlefield, right? You know, I mean, and especially, and it's really phenomenal, because if you consider the culture that comes out of this, it's not a violent culture, you know? I mean, you would think, oh, battlefield religious texts? Oh, they must be, you know, Klingons or something. But, you know, these people are, you know, they get a very, you know, it doesn't have that effect on the culture. Like, you know, if it were taken out of place and placed in the wrong cultural context. See, this is one of the reasons I think it's very careful. You have to be careful when you borrow things from other cultures, because it doesn't have the natural checks and balances that it may have had in its own cultural ecosystem. Much the same way if you take a rat from Europe and drop it in Hawaii, it destroys everything. Same thing can be done with culture. And I'm not going to go into it too much, but there's some of this stuff could, as it was being borrowed, led to Third Reich Nazi occultism and things like this. You know, so you know, the Aryans. Right, that's the swastika. You know, that's where this stuff, again, it was taken out of its culture and dropped into a new culture without the proper set of checks and balances, and then it does some really perverse stuff. You know, the racial theories of the New Age movement, Madame Blavatsky, you know, 19th century, were inspiring people in Europe who ended up becoming the founders of Nazi occultism and this kind of thing here. So, anyway, it can be a very dangerous thing if not in the proper. So, I often will say, like, I tell my students, no, we don't study the Bhagavad Gita until we do Yoga Sutra. You know, first you got to have, like, this, you know, foundation, you know, and understand the ecosystem as much as you can, because you start taking this stuff out of context, it can be very dangerous. So, anyway, I'm not going to say any more about that. Bhishma Parvan. Okay, Bhishma is now general. Okay, so, Shikhandi, remember Amba? He kidnapped her, and she, basically performed asceticism and said that I'm going to kill Bhishma. She's given a garland. She hangs it on Drupada's gate, goes off and burns herself to death, because she's told that the sooner she dies, the sooner she can be reborn as a man. She's reborn as Shikhandini, right? Trades her gender with a yaksha in the forest and becomes Shikhandi and vows to kill. She's born from Drupada, because when she hung that thing, now she becomes Drupada's daughter, who turns into son. Ah, how can I do this without doing the whole story? But anyway, this is interesting. I mean, suffice it to say, there's very interesting gender reversals and things like this that happen. Okay, so at the very beginning at the very end, before the war starts, at the preparation chapter, Bhishma is being appointed as the general, the Kaurava force, and one thing he says, I won't fight a woman. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to fight a woman or anybody who's been a woman. I'm just not going to do it, you know? And he says, I'm not going to kill the Pandavas, you know? And he's like, okay, you want me to be general? Here's my conditions, you know? And Duryodhana is like, yeah, you're still awesome, so you're still the general, right? So basically, Shikhandi comes back. Shikhandi's got this vendetta against Bhishma, because she was kidnapped in her previous life, cost her life, cost her the man that she loved, and now she's reborn as a woman who's now transformed into a man who's going to kill him, okay? So, so at a certain point, Bhishma's just kicking everybody's butt, right? He's just whooping everybody, and he applies this crazy weapon, and Duryodhana actually there's this great episode. I gotta tell this episode because it's this really beautiful devotional moment, right? Duryodhana is constantly like jibing at Drona and Bhishma. You're not really trying, you know. If you're really trying, you would have killed them by now. And so Bhishma picks up these five arrows and says, tomorrow I'm either going to kill the five Pandavas with these arrows, or I'm gonna make Krishna break his vow not to fight. One or the other's gonna happen, okay? Krishna, being the cosmic celestial being, knows of this, says to Arjuna, hey, remember when Duryodhana owed you that promise when you saved his life? Long story. Go use that boon now and ask him for those five arrows. So Arjuna goes to Duryodhana and says, give me those five arrows. He takes them and he destroys them. Duryodhana's like, how did he know about that? Krishna must have told him. Krishna must be the divine god after all. And he prays to Krishna, which is a very interesting moment. Mm-hmm. So the next day in battle, they're fighting. And at a certain point, Krishna picks up a chariot wheel and goes to attack Bhishma, okay? And Arjuna's like, no, don't kill Bhishma, you know, like grabbing on him, don't do it, you know? And Krishna's like, okay, that's cool. And it was like, whew, that was close. And he says, well, I will violate my own vow if it means protecting my devotees, right? So this is one of the main things of devotionalism, is that the Lord will protect you. Right, the Lord will protect, even if it means violating his own vow, the Lord will protect you. So, it's a double entendre. Who is he protecting? Arjuna? Because Bhishma was about to kill Arjuna? Yes. But he was also protecting Bhishma, because Bhishma had made the vow to A, not kill the Pandavas, and B, to not, it's triple entendre, don't kill the Pandavas, and make Krishna fight. So Bhishma's vows were all fulfilled. He made Krishna fight. He didn't have to kill the Pandavas. And at the same time, so he basically protected his devotees by breaking the vows. So it's inspired a lot of art. You know, you see these pictures of, you know, Krishna carrying the chariot wheel about to strike. And what does Bhishma do? Is he's just like, okay, Lord, you know, he just kind of drops down. He's like, okay, you know, and Arjuna's just like desperately like, don't kill Bhishma, you know. So anyway, I had to tell that story. Basically, Bhishma's kicking everybody's butt. Krishna's like, hey, we need to go talk to Bhishma. They go to talk to Bhishma. Bhishma's like, they're like, what are we going to do? How are we going to kill you? And Bhishma's like, I won't fight a woman. And so Krishna's like, oh, okay. So the next day they have Shikhandi go in Arjuna's chariot, fighting Bhishma. Bhishma sees Shikhandi, puts his weapons down because he won't raise a weapon against the woman, right? It's suicidal. I mean, in a sense, Bhishma is committing suicide, you know? And Arjuna, and Krishna says, go. Arjuna basically launches infinite arrows into Bhishma. Bhishma falls down, doesn't touch the ground because there's so many arrows skewering him, so he's laying on the ground, right, his head's hanging down, and the whole battle freezes, and it's like, oh my god, Bhishma's sick. Everybody loves Bhishma. I mean, Bhishma, and myself included, I said last week that Bhishma, I think, is my favorite character in this whole thing. I love Bhishma. He's an awesome guy, you know, he's just always awesome, but he's also got this really sad life. So he's laying there with his head hanging, everybody's coming over, and he's like, my head's hanging, I can't see you guys. And so everybody's like bringing him pillows. He's like, dude, I'm a warrior and you're bringing me these like silk feather pillows. What are you doing? Arjuna, do something. Arjuna shoots three arrows and it kind of picks his head up and creates this arrow pillow. And then night passes, day comes, they all go back, and he's still laying there. And and he's like, oh, I'm thirsty. And everybody's like, starts bringing him food and whatever, you know, drink and everything. He's like, I'm a warrior. You guys are bringing me. I'm dying on the battlefield here, and you guys are pampering me. He's like, no, you know, I'm thirsty. Give me something that's worthy of kshatriya. So Krishna shoots the Arjuna shoots the arrow into the ground, and out springs the Ganges. Whoa. Remember, that's his mother. Whoa. So his mother is now going to feed him as he's dying. His drink. Remember, Svicham Rituhu. He's one who can choose the time of his own death. That was part of his awesome vow, right? And so he doesn't die. And Krishna says to him, you know, you better do the opportune time to die. When the sun is heading to the northern position, that's when you should die, because it's the most auspicious time to die. Until then, you should just lay here. Okay? And Bhishma, you know, being a devotee of the Lord, sure, no problem. So he's like, I'm just going to kick it here. So they kind of like build a tent around him. He's just laying there, you know. And for the rest of the war. The 18-day war. 18-day war. Okay? So Bhishma's dead. Not dead. Bhishma's shish kebab. Okay. Now, Drona's in the charge, right? Sensei Drona, he's going to take over. Killian's in the full swing. Family members are killing family members. Arjuna Abhimanyu, the son of Arjuna now, right? When he was in the womb, he was listening to his father Arjuna tell him what Drona had taught him as a child. And Subhadra's listening to this, right? Subhadra falls asleep, or Krishna stops him, depends on which story you're listening to. But whatever it is, he hears the secret on how to enter the chakra vyuha, which is a battle formation. But because his mom falls asleep, or because Krishna stopped Arjuna from talking, whichever story you're following, he didn't hear the whole story, so he only learns how to enter the chakra vyuha and not how to get out. Again, he's the father of Parikshit. He's 16 years old during this war, right? But he's not too young to fight in war or to impregnate his wife with Parikshit. So, he's educated in the war, he's raised in Dvaraka, etc., etc. So on the 12th day of the battle, first 12 days of the battle, he's just kicking butt. I mean, he's kept Bhishma at bay, he's pierced Karna's armor, he's just done all these awesome things, right? And he kills Duryodhana's son, and Duryodhana says, now we got a target, Abhimanyu, we're all going to get him. So they do the Chakra Vyuha formation, right? I believe Jayadratha engineers that. And he makes his way in, and he doesn't know how to get out, so guess what happens? They tag team him. They all jump on him and kill him, seven of them, right? So again, remember back to our rules of engagement. This is illegal. This is not what you're supposed to do. This is against our rules, right? And Drona had part of that. Karna had part of that. Duryodhana had part of that. Jayadratha had part of that. All these guys, these main players, they all had a part in Abhimanyu's death. And this becomes like the, I don't want to say battle cry, but sort of is. Krishna's always holding this up in everybody's face. You know, whenever it's like, what did the bad guys do? A, they stood by and let Draupadi be humiliated, and B, they killed Abhimanyu in this unfair way. So therefore, we have now thrown out all the wars, rules of engagement. Anything goes. Okay, this is where the war starts getting ugly. Abhimanyu's killed, right? Arjuna blames Jayadratha, vows he's going to kill him before the sun rises the next day. Remember that story with the head fell in his dad's lap? All of that happens, right? Oh, cool. I already told that story. Okay. All right, moving right along, we're almost done, I think. Okay, so Drona now is going to die. What if this can I skip? Okay, I'm going to go through Drona fast. Okay, so basically, what happens with Drona is Drona again is kicking butt. They're like, "What are we going to do?" Krishna's like, "I got a plan." Drona loves his son Ashwatthama so much, right? And if Ashwatthama is killed, Drona will be incapacitated with grief. And that's when we have to kill him. And they're like, we can't kill Ashwatthama. They're like, and Krishna's like, well, why don't you like name that elephant Ashwatthama and kill the elephant? And so they're like, okay, kill the elephant, right? And Yudhishthira is, Ashwatthama is dead! I'm not sure if it was the human or the elephant. Ashwatthama is dead! I'm not sure if it was the human or the elephant. And of course, you know, Krishna has like these trumpets play as he's saying this. So, Yudhishthira cannot lie, and Drona knows that. So when Drona hears Ashwatthama is dead, he fears the worst. Right? So again, adharmic behavior, unrighteous behavior on the part of the good guys. So Drona falls on the ground, and then there's the son of Drupada, Drupada kids together, Drona poor, Drupada king, Drona goes to Drupada, I'm not giving you anything, I'm going to have a son, I'm going to have my students capture half of your kingdom. Now that you did that, I'm going to have a kid that's going to kill you. That kid is the one that killed him, okay? So, beheads him. And it's also considered cowardice. There's said Duna gets blamed for this, for being a coward, because Drona has stepped off of the chariot again, violating the rules of engagement. He's basically on his knees, meditating, sending his spirit up into heaven to find his son. His spirit is in heaven, looking for his son. He's like, where's my son? Is he really dead? And that's when Dushyanta goes, cuts his head off and he's dead. Okay, so that's what happens. Karna now is the general. Okay, Karna had three curses against him. I think I told you of them. One is that he accidentally, when he was target practicing, killed a cow, had a curse. Kid spilled the ghee. He picked up the earth and squeezed the ghee out. And the earth mother's like, what are you doing? Now you're going to be stuck, right? And then also when he was when his guru was sleeping on his head, and the worm burrowed through and bled, and the guru Parashurama hates kshatriyas, says you must be a kshatriya, you're going to forget your mantra. So he's got these three curses operating against him, right? And he's out to fight. I'm not going to go into Shaya. I'm not going to say it. I guess I said it. So basically, he's angry. And also, he called Draupadi a whore, right? During that whole dicing scene, he kind of got into it too. And this is one of the reasons why Arjuna's really mad. You know, Arjuna's like, I'm going to get that guy. You don't call my wife a whore, right? So basically, we can go through that pretty fast. The battle starts to happen. Karna gets stuck in the mud because of the curses, right? He squeezed the earth. Mm-hmm. He killed the cow when it was helpless. Now he's stuck helpless. There, he's having this great battle with Arjuna. He's actually praising Arjuna. He's like, Arjuna, you're the raddest opponent ever. You're so awesome. I'm stuck in the mud. Can you hang on 1 second while I do this? We'll get right back to it. You're great. Let me just do this. He jumps off the chariot and he starts unsticking the chariot, and Krishna taps Arjuna on the shoulder and says, now. And Arjuna's like, he's not on the chariot. He's like, go. And Arjuna kind of like, I mean, there's different versions of the story, but, you know, Arjuna kind of turns around. You know, the Karna Sambarta is the kavya that I've read and translated with this. He turns around and he says, you know, what are you going to do? Shoot me? And Arjuna's like, kill him. Right? Maybe he got decapitated, depending on which stories you hear. So this is when Karna dies. And that's how he dies. We're not going to go through all that.
Did
there's
know
all
he
of
was
this.
Brother?
What's that?
Did he know he was his brother?
Not yet. He finds out. Yeah, he finds out later at the end of the war. Yeah, it becomes a very, very sad thing. Actually, all the brothers, when they find out, Kunti tells them at the end of the war. And they're like, why didn't you? Okay, so you destroy curses. He says, from now on, you kept that secret. We killed our own brother, our older brother. We did that because you kept the secret. From now on, women cannot keep secrets. And that's why, to this day, which is the reason why that story is told. I know about women, but I don't hold secrets very good. Okay, so Shaya takes over whatever Shaya dies. Okay, I'm not going to do that because I'm going to wrap this up. So Ashwatthama, I got to talk about how Duryodhana dies, right? At this point, Karna is dead. That's his buddy. That's his right-hand man. It said that when Duryodhana's entire 100 brothers get slaughtered, he doesn't shed one tear, but when Karna dies, he's inconsolable, right? That's at the point when Gandhari says, come to me, my son, naked. And Krishna's like, oh, your mother? Maybe you should put some pants on. And so he goes with the pants on. Gandhari looks at him, makes his entire body indestructible, but because he's covered, his legs are not. Now, back at the dicing scene, when Draupadi was being humiliated, one of the things that he did is he pulled up this, exposed his bare thigh to Draupadi, and he said, come sit on my thigh. This is, again, like sexual harassment. This is a very salacious thing to say, you know. Come sit on my thigh, right? Slaps his thigh. And Bhima says, I'm going to break that leg. I vow to break that leg. And then when Dushasana humiliates, ripping off her robe, Bhima says, I'm going to drink his blood. And Draupadi says, I will not tie my hair up until I've washed it in your blood. Right? So these vows start to come true. Duryodhana is inconsolable after Karna's dead. He goes and he hides in a lake. Right? If you've seen the Peter Brooks adaptation of the Mahabharata, I don't know if you have. It's really silly because this part is like this lake and there's like this little face under it and it's like, leave me alone! It's kind of like skulking under the lake or something. The way I was reading the Mahabharata, I kind of just took it as like, dude, the guy just like went to take a swim, you know? I mean, but I don't know. This is Peter Brooks' adaptation. I'm sure it's justified. But the Pandavas track him down. They find him and they're like, dude, come on out. We're going to kill you. And he's like, okay, fine. And Krishna's like, you can pick whoever you want to fight. And he's got the same animosity with Bhima, right? And he's like, okay, Bhima, you and I are on. We're going to fight with the maces because they're both pros with this mace, right? And they're fighting on some like 27 hours or whatever. And they, you know, Bhima's getting worn out. Big old Bhima's getting worn out. And he's starting to like think, oh, I'm going to lose. And at that turn point, Krishna goes like this, right? And Bhima understands, and he hits him. In the translation I was just reading this morning, it said the groin, but I've also heard it the thigh, because that's the thigh that he slapped. Hits him below the belt, again, against the rules of engagement. Again, Krishna telling them to break the rules of Dharma that they'd agreed to. You know? And again, whenever this is justified, Krishna's like, dude, you guys killed Abhimanyu. You know, the rules of Dharma are gone the second you got, you broke them first. You know, and so he goes back to that. And then he also goes back and he says, oh, actually, at this point, Balarama answers. You remember Balarama's brother, who's the conscientious objector, comes on the scene and is like, what are you doing? you know? He says to his brother, the Supreme Lord, what are you doing, you know? And he's like, yeah, you're right. What I and Duryodhana protests. He says, look, dude, you killed Karna, you killed Drona, you killed Bhishma, and now you're killing me, all by trickery, all by deceit. Every single main guy you've killed, you've done it dishonestly, right? And Krishna just basically is like, yeah, you're right. This is what I like about Krishna. I think Krishna comes by as a really likable character in the Mahabharata, because whenever anybody accuses him, I don't know whenever, but there are places where he gets accused, and he owns it. He's like, yeah, you're right, but we had to win the war. You know, we had this larger thing. And, you know, so later on, after the war, you know, the women are all coming to the battlefield and weeping, and, you know, everything is terrible, and Gandhari is lamenting over her 100 dead sons, and she says to Krishna, you officiated over the massacre of my family. I curse you. You're going to watch your entire Yadava lineage die. Because, and you don't mess with Gandhari, remember? That blindfold gave her a lot of power. And what does Krishna do? He doesn't say, hey, you stupid woman, I'm the Supreme Lord. You think you're... He says, no, he says, you're right. He's like, I accept that. That's my karma. Right? And then later on, his whole family dies, and he knows why, you know? So Duryodhana gets hit, he gets left there to die. Ashwatthama meets up with him and gets really upset and vows revenge. He goes to the camp, the nighttime camp of the Pandavas, and kills everyone, all of them, including five of what he thinks are Pandavas. Well, these are not the Pandavas, these are the Upa Pandavas. These are Draupadi's five sons. Where's Draupadi? Draupadi on it? Where are you, Draupadi? Oh, Draupadi. Draupadi's five sons, okay? He brings a bag full of heads back to the dying Duryodhana who's laying on the ground after being hit by a leg. And he says, look, I killed him. And he pulls up the head and he's like, well, give me the head of Bhima. He's like, this one's Bhima. Right? And he's like, okay. And he holds it and the head doesn't roll away. He says, this isn't Bhima's head, because if this is Bhima's head, he wouldn't face me even in death. You know? He's like, you just killed the Upa Pandavas. You killed their kids. And this, like, and Ashwatthama kind of has this, like, epiphany. Oh. And this is kind of this point where, and then Duryodhana dies of grief. Because then he realizes that there is no more heir to Hastinapura. They've all been killed. And I think he has this kind of moment of personal accountability where he's just like, look what I did. And then he dies. So Ashwatthama is struck with grief. He goes to Vyasa's ashram for sanctification, right? He's hanging out with Vyasa. The Pandavas go and pursue him. And when the Pandavas go, he discharges a weapon, right? Arjuna happens to know the same weapon, too, and Arjuna discharges it. Now, Drona taught them this weapon. Ashwatthama was Drona's son, remember. But he didn't teach Drona Ashwatthama the entire thing. He taught him how to discharge it, not to recall it. Because the idea is if you discharge it and recall it, you can do it over again. Discharge, recall, discharge. But if you don't know how to recall it, you can only discharge it once and it's gone, right? So he didn't really trust his son as much, but he did trust Arjuna to be able to discharge and recall. So they both discharge his weapon, and it looks like reassured mutual destruction, you know, to implore Cold War rhetoric. It looks like it's going to destroy the entire earth. Vyasa intervenes and he's like, dude, recall your weapons. Arjuna's like, okay, sorry. Recalls the weapons. Ashwatthama's like, I don't know how. He's like, well, then you got to redirect it somewhere. So he says, okay, Uttara. And directs it to Abhimanyu's surviving widow, who is pregnant with Parikshit. It hits him, baby's born, stillborn, dead. Right? And Krishna actually brings the baby back to life. That's why the name Parikshit means like destroyed. He's the kid who was destroyed. Right? So, barely saving the lineage. Because actually technically he was dead, but he was brought back to life. So, that's what happens with that. Anyway, Ashwatthama does the massacre. I think I got like one or two more pages here. Okay, the war ends. Pandavas rule for 36 years. Parikshit rules for 27 years. Janamejaya.
Wait, how did they win?
They just basically killed everybody. Once Karna was dead, you know, Duryodhana lost his steam. And once Duryodhana died, basically everybody just went in retreat. All the Kaurava forces just retreated, you know, or everybody was dead. You know, that's pretty much it. And then the entire city, the entire country is filled with grieving women. You know, it's a whole chapter on the grief of the women, you know, listening to the women weeping. It's heart-wrenching stuff to read because you really think of it. I mean, it impresses upon you the cost of war, you know, it really does. You know. Anyway, so this grief is happening everywhere, right? This whole thing. Yudhishthira is not thrilled with the whole thing. He's constantly trying to reject the throne. He's like, dude, I don't want to be the king. Keep it. I want to go live in the forest and be ascetic. And everybody has to keep talking him into to doing that. Now, Bhishma's not dead, right? So he goes back to the battlefield, meets with Bhishma, and Bhishma gives him the discourse on how to be a a good king. You know, they talk about the Dharma of Kings, the Purusharthas, the four stages of life, Varna, caste, etc. All these different, how to raise revenue, how to fight your enemies, the roles of the... They just gives them this whole huge discourse on society so that he knows how to be a good king. And then Bhishma, when the auspicious time happens, 54 days later, he decides to choose to die. He practices pranayama, breath control. His wounds magically disappear, and like a comet, his prana shoots out of the top of his head and goes to the celestial realm. And Bhishma's a badass, and that's how he goes. So, anyway, let's switch this up. All right, and I think we're closing it up here. Okay, so decline and death. Woo! Yeah! Okay. So, remember Gandhari's cursed Krishna's clan, the Yadavas. Right? They're cursed. They're going to die. So what happens is one day Shamba, which is one of Krishna's sons, they're in Dwarka. The rishis are coming to town, and they decide to play a trick on these rishis, these sages, these munis, these wise guys, right? And so they like, let's dress up Shamba like a woman and have him go before this rishi. So he goes before this rishis dressed as a woman. They're like, hey, rishis, you guys are so smart. What's he going to have? What's she going to have? Is it going to be a boy or a girl? What's she going to have? What's that?
Pregnant woman.
Pregnant.
You didn't mention that part.
Yeah.
Dressed up like a pregnant woman.
Yeah.
Sorry, my brain is going at this point. And the rishis are like, you can have a ball of iron. All right. So he gives birth to, you didn't think it was possible, male birth, gives birth through a very small hole to a large clump of iron. Right? And so basically, Ugrasena is still in charge, and he's like, dude, this is bad. Let's get rid of it. Crush it up in powder, throw it in the ocean, we'll pretend this never happened, don't tell Krishna, everything will be okay. They dump it in the ocean, but this stuff is cursed, man. So these cattails, iron cattails, start growing, and they turn into these bamboo spears and all these bad omens. You hear the jackals howling, the sky turns weird colors, people are having strange dreams. Now alcoholism becomes rampant. You know, this is one of the four major Vedic sins, is drinking alcohol, right? And so once alcohol starts getting into the scene, they start getting drunk, and there becomes like this kind of like brawl, basically, where they, one of the three accomplices of Ashwatthama, remember when he did that massacre and he killed all those guys in the middle of the night, including Nupa, the sons of Draupadi, he's hanging out in Varka, and you know, some of these guys who fought on the side of Pandava is like, dude, you know, you killed their whole family. What a jerk. And so it creates this like conflict and animosity. They all kill each other. Like, this like war breaks out, this riot, and all the men kill each other. The women are left alone. Balarama is just like, again, he's like kind of the conscientious objector. He's like, dude, screw this, I'm leaving. And Krishna's like, I'm going to the forest for penance, right? Either Yudhishthira hears about it and sends Arjuna, or Krishna sends for Arjuna, depending on which story you're listening to. But whatever the case is, there's only women left and nobody to take care of them. So it's Arjuna's job now to leave Hastinapura and get the women and bring them back. But guess what? It turns out Arjuna is kind of over the hill. He brings all these women back, but he gets attacked by bandits. He can't defend them. The women end up immolating themselves, burning themselves alive, or drowning themselves, and committing suicide. And he can't protect them. His quiver, which was infinite arrows, now he only has limited arrows. And it's kind of like, you guys are old and in the way, right? And he comes back to Hastinapura. They hear Krishna is now off in the forest. This hunter Jara is fishing, and he pulls up a fish with a chunk of iron in it, right? Because that iron that got deposited, he fashions it into an arrow, and he's out hunting, and he sees a deer, and he goes, bam, whoops, that wasn't a deer. You know, whenever they go hunting, right, it's Krishna. Hits Krishna perhaps in the toe, perhaps in the Achilles tendon, you know, maybe some overlap with the story of Achilles, but it happens to be what kills him. And as Krishna is leaving to go to the forest, one of the things he witnesses is he sees his brother Balarama, and he sees a giant serpent like come out of his mouth and slither off into the ocean, and you know, that's Balarama dying. But Balarama is the celestial incarnation of Sesha, which is a serpent that sleeps on whatever. So Krishna is now shot and he's dead. They hear about it back at Hastinapura, and Yudhishthira's had enough. He's like, that's it. I'm not being a king anymore. I never wanted this. This has been nothing but headache. We've killed everybody in our family. Forget this. Let's get out of here. Let's just get Parikshit on the throne, and let's take off. So they install Parikshit. They go on pilgrimage, wandering around the country. They start heading back up to the Himalayas. They start climbing. On the way, they bump into a dog that follows them around. He likes this little dog, which is unusual in Indian culture because dogs are like looked down upon, really. But this dog ends up being this like loyal friend. So as they climb the Himalayas, one by one, they fall and die. You know, they ask Yudhishthira, why did they die? Why did Draupadi die? And it's like, well, there's a reason for all of them. Well, because Draupadi actually said she loved all her husbands equally. Secretly, she loved Arjuna more, and that's why she died. Bhima died. Oh, why did he die? Well, he was kind of a glutton. He liked to eat too much, so he died. Well, why did, you know, et cetera. So they all go, and there's like a reason. And finally, they're all dead, except for Arjuna and his dog, and they get invited up to heaven. Right? And at this point, I always imagine this is like, you know, this, like the hot air balloon ladder, the rope ladder kind of drops out of the heavens, and, you know, Yudhishthira's looking up going, hey, right on. And they're like, come to heaven. Was that? And what Yudhishthira says, he says, okay, let's go. And they're like, oh, yeah, but dog's got to stay behind. And he's like, my dog? Uh-uh. You know, it's dharma that whenever there's a dependent, you take care of the dependent, whatever, this is my dog. I'm not leaving him. Fine, I shoot heaven. I'll stay here on earth and die, you know. And lo and behold, second dharma test, right? It was dharma. Oh, just kidding. I'm dharma. Actually, your dog can come up to heaven, too. So he comes up. So all dogs go to heaven, right? So he comes up to heaven. He goes to heaven, and they're like, check it out. You're in heaven. Look, there's Duryodhana. There's Dushasana. There's all the bad guys. All the Kauravas are, like, hanging around. He's like, oh, great. I'm glad you guys all made it. Where's my brothers? And the person who's leading is like, oh, well, let's come over here. And starts taking him down this, like, dark corridor down into hell. And he's like, what's this? And he comes down there, and they're in hell. He's in the pits of hell. And his brothers and his wife are, like, calling out, no, help us, don't leave us. And they're like, yeah, it turns out your brothers and your family didn't do so well. But you're in. You can come up to heaven. And Yudhishthira's like, no, I'm not going to heaven. My brother's down here, I'm staying with my brothers. And guess what? Third dharma test. Just kidding, we're all in heaven. Everybody's up there. It's all happy. And Vaishampayana says, I have told everything that Vyasa narrated. Whoever hears this Veda washes away a million sins. Hearing this, Janamejaya is thrilled. If I may, 3 seconds. Something about the reception here. So basically, you know, 10th, 11th century, the Kavya tradition, this poetry tradition, this idea of rasas, it means like taste, you know, these different emotions that are supposed to be expressed in epic in poetry come about, and they kind of get this question of what is the rasa behind the, there's 8 of them, what is the rasa, what is the feeling behind the Mahabharata, and they come up with this idea that it's shanta rasa, right, peace, right, which is kind of ironic for this book, right? It's just all war the whole way through. Peace rasa. And the idea is that when you hear this horrible, awful story, you kind of decide that you're going to eschew material pursuits. You kind of realize that chasing fame and fortune and materialism, look what it did for these guys, you know? And it's like, so you develop a sense of viragya, non-attachment, right? A non-passion for sensory pursuits. And from that viragya, from that detachment to material pursuits, that's where the shanta comes. And so upon hearing the story, you as the audience are supposed to be left with a sense of screw materialism, cultivate non-attachment, and accept internal peace as opposed to looking to the external sources for happiness. We can find our own internal sources of happiness because ultimately, whatever your external source of happiness is, will ultimately disappoint you and lead you to sadness the way it has with the characters of the Mahabharata.
Now we go to the Hari Vamsa.
On behalf of Many Rivers, thank you so much. That was totally awesome. Now I see how small the visions of Hollywood are in comparison to the imagination here, as well as the philosophical implications as well.
Well, it's always my hope that the mythology of Hollywood can somehow grow. But when you have copyright laws, that actually stifles it. But if people could, like, if I could write another Star Wars episode right now, that would be like what happened in the Mahabharata time. But because we don't allow that, we're stifling our own intellectual growth.
Got it. And I agree. And I am so grateful for your all coming out, supporting this incredible event. It's been really great. I hope you will express your appreciation by making donations to help the speaker tonight recover some of his energy expended the last couple of weeks, and to, of course, help maintain this space. Thank you all for the support for this special series, and we look forward to more fun things in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, please, you guys. I was mentioning... Oh, yeah, sorry. I teach a yoga sutra class. I own a yoga studio. If anybody's interested in learning more about Sanskrit literature, culture, memorizing sutras, all that stuff, I own a yoga studio in Pengrove, Sonoma Yoga Martial Arts. And I should... Sonoma Yoga Martial Arts. And I should mention that these books... I was talking about Winthrop Sargent here this morning in class, if anybody's interested in picking that up. I don't know if you got that, but that's the grammatical analysis of the Bhagavad Gita. And also, I highly recommend this Tripurari Bhagavad Gita here as well, too. I read that one a lot, and I like it. So anyway, please... patronize many rivers. Thank you. Hey, we made it. All right. Thanks for coming, brother. Take care of yourself.
What are you doing tomorrow?
Yeah, it's homework from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. I got to get 14 hours in. Today I was supposed to do homework, but my parents did. So I got to catch up tomorrow.
Hey, did you ever hang that?
No, dude, my frame guy is not coming through. Yeah, if you feel like you know somebody who can do it, I'm open to it.
I think I'd have to check with him and make sure that he's not doing it.
It's really big, so it's got to be like custom.
Well, that it's true. I mean, it's a multi-$100 job, and this guy, you know, he does good work, and he'll give me a deal because his kids are training with me for free.
So the cool thing is, you can get one of these. I did it with two other pieces from Nepal, like a glass cover with magnets. I just don't know if they got that.
Oh, Susan, Susan.
Actually. Okay.
That's the one.
I have a question. Is it your intention to recite the Bhagavad Gita one day?
Oh yeah. I'm hoping to do it in the next 5 years, pretty close. I've been getting better.
In Sanskrit, or will you translate it as well?
Well, I'm a student of Sanskrit, and because Sanskrit isn't a spoken language, you don't have the ability to just like go hang out with people. Like if you were learning German, you'd hang out with Germans. I can't really do that.
No.
So what I have to do is I have to recite literature, memorize literature, and that's how I learn the language. So it's through the memorization and the recitation of the literature.
That you're actually learning.
Exactly. So what I do is before I memorize a chapter is I take all the vocabularies, I do all the grammatical analysis, I put in, I make about 500 or 600 flashcards, I learn all of that, and then I memorize it so I know what I'm saying as I'm saying it, and then I help understand the grammatical structure, and then, you know, but it's also part of my spiritual practice as well, too, because, you know, obviously having that going in your head all day long is, you know, really thing to have. So anyway, it's a good thing, and if you, I don't know how much I can talk to you about this, but when you recite things, when you study the mental processes, the cognitive skills that you learn in meditation and like the Yoga Sutra, you realize that you're employing those very same cognitive skills in the process of memorizing and reciting a text. I guess that's probably the most I'm going to say, but meditation is not necessarily just sitting around hanging out waiting for something to happen. It may be in some context, but you can also think of it as a specific set of cognitive skills that you can develop. And one of the ways that you can develop that skill is by memorizing and learning and reciting texts. Because remember, these ideas of meditation were put together in a culture where people had huge volumes of information memorized. So part of what they were describing when they were describing their cognitive mental processes are some of the things that they were experiencing when they were reciting texts. So anyway, I teach more about that in the Yoga Sutra class. If you're ever interested in that, you know, you're welcome to come as well. But yeah, certainly memorizing.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because I've avoided,
you know, I'm
a student at the Shambhala Meditation Center, and I never go on the nights that they do the sutras. And the reason is, my reason has been, I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
And that's what I've been told.
Yeah, like, it's the process.
You trust it. Do you trust the teaching? Then you sit and you do it. And it's going to come.
Yeah. And he'll start to understand it too.
And I keep thinking,
notice that very process.
No, I'm not.
There's something magical also about saying a language you don't understand. Because when I was first memorized, I memorized the entire Yoga Sutra before the Bhagavad Gita, and I didn't know Sanskrit back then. I wasn't trained in it. But when you don't know what you're saying, it takes you out of your discursive mind a little bit more.
Right.
So, yeah, essentially, but not in an improvised way.
Right.
See, that's the trick. It's simultaneously improvised, but it's also simultaneously premeditated. That's the other thing. Is that if you're too improvised, you're too, I guess the way I would say it is, too released. But if you're too focused, you're too attached, and you got to find that balance in between. So in the process of recitation, that becomes the sweet spot that starts to happen, like an artist when they're painting or something, where you're, it's coming out of you with not, because if you and it's forced accountability. See, the reason I prefer recitation to sitting meditation, I practice both, but I think recitation is so important because it's a system of forced accountability. If you sit on the meditation cushion, who's to say that your mind is not straying? Who's to say that you're not doing your daily thing? But if you're reciting and your mind slips, you say it wrong, right? You frustrate yourself by saying it wrong. So unless you get right in that zone where it's coming right out of you just perfectly, if you try too hard, it won't come out. If you're too relaxed, your mind will sway and you won't have it, but you're in that right spot, and then that's what happens. So on the surface, it feels like your mind should be empty when you're meditating, but that's a qualified emptiness. It's an emptiness that's preceded by an attachment and then a letting go, not just a letting go. Anyway, it's all kind of crazy stuff.
Question?
Yeah.
A friend of mine said that the war, he had to fight his relatives. Those were really his ego.
That's part of what I was going to say.
He was attacked.
His
own baggage, internal baggage.
It's a popular interpretation. It really is. Eknath Ishwaran, Gandhi, many people have taken this idea that the Bhagavad Gita is an internal, like Gandhi was confronted. He's like, Gandhi, ahimsa parama dharma, nonviolence is the supreme law of the universe. Yes, but Gandhi, you love the Bhagavad Gita, you study the Bhagavad Gita, it's a book of war. You know, and Gandhi says, this is not war, this is an internal war that you have. You know, and then the chariot, you know, like the chariot, the five horses are the five senses.
So you're really slaying the, your lack of integrity.
If Duryodhana represents anger and envy and jealousy and all of these things, that's part of what you're at war with. You know, this war represents the factions of powers inside your mind that are vying. But at the same time, there's a certain amount of existential suicide that happens in the spiritual process as well, too. So that's why Battlefield is a good allegory for that, if you can follow what I'm saying. But it's but it's a popular way of interpreting the Bible.
I just wanted your verification of it.
Yeah, that's a great way to do. Well, when Gandhi was confronted with that, as he said, it's an internal process. You know, but this started way in the post-Vedic period when the ritual was an external process, and at a certain point they said the ritual was actually a symbol for internal process. This happened 2,500 years ago, so that's a very, very old way of interpreting religious actions. It's like you're lighting the candle, you're waving the flame, and all that, but it's actually symbolic for an internal. That was one of the innovations of the post-Vedic thought.
It's symbolic for an internal struggle, but it also manifests itself in the real world.
Yeah.
As real world.
Yeah. Well, the way I think about it is, I think of life as a battlefield, which is kind of on the surface. It's like, what do you mean you're at war all the time? It means two things. It means, you know, certainly there's war all the time, but war, if you can get a sense of mental equanimity within the context of the battlefield, you can have the sense of equanimity anywhere. So your loved ones die. You know, if you are in this battlefield mindset, it's not that you're angry and you're hateful and you want to kill people, which is what people will think when you say that. It's that you're trying to develop a sense of mental equanimity in the most harsh environment imaginable. And that's how you're training your mind, so that when life does deliver these difficult circumstances, you've already trained. You know your way. You know where that mental equanimity is. You know, not to say that you don't feel grief and sorrow. You feel it. It's just not the primary sense of your orientation. Instead of grief and sorrow being the biggest thing happening in your head, it's more of a distant thing happening in your head when this mental stability is the real thing that's your primary orientation.
Because you have the stability, you can go through it unscathed, or at least go through it and make it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It doesn't destroy you. Bad things make you better instead of worse, right?
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for coming. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm really glad you guys all made it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I do, yeah. We have a sutra class on Saturday mornings.
Hopefully, I'm in the process of one day wanting to open a temple. We also have kirtan events and other things here as well.
I don't know if I'll ever get any of it, but it's sure great to. You got to the main point in the last three sentences.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that principle of Vaivagya that I touched on in the back is very, very important. It's a central teaching to yoga, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, if you'd like to hear more, you know, Saturday mornings at 9:30. So.
Okay.
All right, thank you for coming.
And that's in Pengrove?
Pengrove, yes, ma'am. Okay, all right, thank you.
Did you stop it?
I didn't. Maybe they didn't.
Yes.
Okay.